Good morning, everybody. Happy New Year, such as it is. May we have a roll call, please?
Bruce Rinker.
Here.
Debbie Berry.
Here.
Dan Moore.
Here.
Three members are present, which constitutes a quorum.
Please join us in the pledge.
I pledge allegiance to the flag.
To the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands. One nation, under God, indivisible, liberty.
Wow.
Did somebody have their mic?
That's how 21 starts off.
It's the great Oz. Pay no attention.
My, oh my.
Our next, first order of business really is presentation of the journal entry from Judge Russo for appointment of park commissioners for 2021.
Thank you. Debbie, if you want to raise your right hand. I state your name.
I, Debbie Berry.
Do hereby swear.
Do hereby swear.
That I will support the Constitution of the United States of America.
That I will support the Constitution of the United States of America.
And the Constitution of the State of Ohio.
And the Constitution of the State of Ohio.
And that I will faithfully, honestly, and impartially.
And that I will faithfully, honestly, and impartially.
Discharge the duties as a member.
Discharge the duties as a member.
Of the Board of Park Commissioners.
Of the Board of Park Commissioners.
Of Cleveland Metropolitan Park District.
Of Cleveland Metropolitan Park District.
This I promise to do as I shall swear, as I shall answer unto God.
This I promise to do as I shall answer unto God.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And I think we can vouch for Ms. Berry's commitment to the oath of her office, unlike some.
And the Constitution.
Thank you very much.
Is there a motion to accept the new officers of the Board of Park Commissioners, being Dan Moore as president and Bruce Rinker and Debbie Berry as vice presidents?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Well, I guess we start, I can start out now.
That's correct.
Well, let's have, discuss the adoption of the bylaws.
And if I may, President Moore, the resolution for the council is always a bit buried in the agenda there. But we do need the appointment of council. And we see that recommended action fall on the top of page 2.
Okay, so.
And just as a matter of reference, there are no increase in fees. This is our last year of the legal RFP, so we'll see a major request for proposal issued next fall for legal counsel. And so there's really no change to the resolution from last year.
So we just need a motion?
That's correct.
So moved. I'll second then.
All in favor?
Aye.
Motion carries.
And a zippy.
Now can we discuss the adoption of the bylaws? I saw very few changes.
That's correct. We, in the section that dealt with the executive session in the public meetings, we just clarified it. I felt the language was not as clear. And then the only substantive change is that we have clarified how we can use the auction, how and when we can use the auction process. But if the board determines and if staff determines that an item is of no value, we have the parameters under Ohio law to donate those items. And so those are the clarifications in the bylaws.
Very good. Do we have a motion to accept the previous edits?
We do. So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
And just as a clarification, that was the motion for the adoption of the bylaws, and now we're going on to the minutes.
Yes.
Oh, okay, now we approve the minutes.
Yes, now we go to the minutes.
Okay, motion approved, yes. Onto the financial report.
Well, excuse me, just let's have that motion on the minutes.
Okay.
That's right.
I apologize. I would move that we adopt, approve the minutes for December 17th.
Second that.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Financial report, please.
Bill is joining us.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Bill.
It's Oz.
Okay, and David, you are allocating share credentials, I believe, yes?
Yep.
There we go. Great, thank you.
It does look like Oz with.
It does. Where's the flame?
Okay, I believe we are now sharing. Okay, great. So we have our financial performance through December 30th of this year. So it is our soft close year-end report. We will still have a hard close, if you will, once we go ahead and wrap up all of our account reconciliations and final entries, but we don't expect too much substantive change. This is representative of where we're gonna land. And as we look at the overall performance, we can highlight that for charges for services in December, we actually held our own. We did slightly better than December of last year. So this puts us down about $8.5 million from where we were in 2019 for the year, a little bit better actually than we had expected this summer when everything really accelerated and we were trying to get our hands around where the pandemic was going to affect us. So we managed through that fairly well. And we got a really nice bump, if you will, of $1.2 million for the dividend check from the Bureau of Workers' Compensation, which you can see here in the other line. So that's obviously exciting for us as well. So what this does is it puts us in a total revenue perspective of $126,830,000, and it's about $6 million behind where we were last year after we get the benefit of doing a little bit more in the grants and donations category and the extra $1.2 million from the dividend check. Now you can see that on salaries and benefits, we've done a really good job keeping our financial stability by offsetting that revenue loss with the compensation line. We saved about $8.6 million from where we were last year. And we also did a really good job on the operational line where we saved about $7 million from where we were last year, allowing us to continue our capital commitment this year. Our total operating expenses with those two major savings were about $15.6 million less than they were last year. And that puts our operating surplus at $9.6 million over 2019. We give some of that back with the capital activity and land acquisition that we did this year. We did a little bit over $28 million in capital expenditures. That's about $4.4 million more than we did in 2019. And then from a net perspective, where this puts us is about $5.1 million more surplus than 2019. But I do want to caution, this is not additional cash, if you will, because our encumbrances are over $5 million higher than they were at the end of 19. So in other words, our contractual obligations that are rolling into 2021 basically put us at a net position, very comparable to where we were in 2019, which I think is really an accomplishment given everything that's been thrown at the Park District and the general economy and public this year. So I'm pleased about that. When we look at the zoo, we can see that we ended up on a net basis about $4.6 million behind where we were last year from a revenue perspective. I believe we ended up around 740,000 guests this year versus about 1.2 million last year. You can see here in December, we're about 32,000 off of where we were in December of 19. We have experienced some really good activity with wild winter lights. I believe we're gonna crest about 105,000 guests, maybe even approach 106 as we wrap up. Now, the one thing I will mention is we, out of this revenue number, we do have about $500,000 that we owe our partner for wild winter lights that we're paying in early January that will offset some of the special event admissions revenue here. As we look at our operational expenditures, we've actually saved about $4.2 million at the zoo from where we were in 2019, which almost offsets the revenue contraction. Our operating subsidy only increased at the end of the day, $466,000 over 2019, which again, obviously we're not excited about operating increasing a subsidy on an operating basis, but I'm pleased that we were able to keep it under $500,000 given some of the challenges this year. There's really been a lot of remarkable pivoting by the zoo to figure out ways to continue to get some revenue in the door, even having 3 months of basically being closed. We spent about $1.1 million more in capital expenditures this year. The majority of the construction expenses in this category is for the Rainforest Dome, which was obviously very well needed and a great improvement. And that puts us at a net subsidy position of about $1.6 million behind where we were at this point in 2019. And then from the restricted fund perspective, the restricted expenses that you see here are predominantly for the Rhino Yard expansion and some of the gorilla and primate beginning phase costs as well. Looking at golf, golf was just behind where it was last year in December, about $12,000. But overall for the year, it's up about $1.4 million from 2019. 400,000 nine-hole rounds, really remarkable. That's up 33%. So just the activity levels were astounding this year. And which is even more astounding is as we mentioned, we've actually spent $249,000 less in operating expenses this year, supporting that additional $1.4 million in revenue. So the team has just worked so hard and really had a banner year. And from an operating surplus perspective, we can see here it's about $2.3 million or $1.6 million more than it was in 2019. And then on a net basis after our capital expenditures, we ended up at about a net surplus of $1.9 million, which is 2.7 ahead of where we were in 2019. So golf really contributed significantly to the park's operations this year.
It shows what happens when people are allowed to work at home. They go out and play golf.
No comment on that one. That's very true. When we look at the per course activity here, it's worth highlighting that Sleepy Hollow and Seneca both ended up over $1.6 million in revenue. So just a ton of play. And you're right. So people had apparently some means and some time, and we're able to get outside and enjoy the courses this year.
Fantastic.
Not quite the same story with Enterprise as we jump to that. However, I would like to highlight that in December, we actually did 78,000 more in revenue in Enterprise than we did in 2019. So really a good month driven by Riverfest and the activities down at Rivergate and Merwin's, as well as the chalet. Even though the chalet has less capacity as we've restricted it to keep safe distancing, what we do have is being sold out on a regular basis. So this puts us about $3.9 million behind where we were in revenue last year from an enterprise perspective. And then when we look at the operating expenses, we saved about $3 million. So we were able to offset a good portion of that lost revenue, but we still ended up in a subsidy position that was $892,000 worse than it was in 2019. So a very challenging year, but we're trying to figure out, and with some success as December shows, how to get creative with trying to drive some revenue through this group. And kudos to Joe and his team for what they're doing in terms of the creativity, which is evidenced by Rivergate. From a net subsidy perspective, not significantly different, a little bit better, $839,000 more subsidy this year than we had last year as well. And on a per location basis, really not much to highlight here beyond what we've talked about in prior meetings, most of our locations having minimal activity or being closed. And we see the same thing when we look here. The only thing I'll mention about the chalet is we have to remember that we're comparing calendar years, which are split seasons. So in other words, our December 2020 numbers are for the winter into spring of 20 and now the fall into winter of 20. So it's not the kind of the straddled 2021 season or 1920 season that we see in total for the chalet. It splits over the calendar year. And that is the update for through year end, unless there's any questions.
Very good. Can I ask one question? I'm sure we've been thinking about this year and this summer in particular, how we could perhaps get some of the government subsidies that are going to be coming for youth education and youth training. How we could get some people, probably seniors in high school that could perhaps help us out on some projects at the park here. I can't say what, but maybe digging trails or something that has to do with manual labor, sort of a la WPA.
What I can speak to currently is we're not aware of any programs that are currently available at this point in time. We have used AmeriCorps, we've used summer youth employment programs. We've done programs like these in the past. But to say that there's any federal funding at this point in time is premature. We're not aware of any funding. If there does become funding available, we will certainly look to supplement. As the commissioners know, we cut about $4 million of our seasonal budget last year, so we would certainly like to prop that up if we could through different programs. So if they're available, we will certainly go after them. If there's any funds in the COVID funds or COVID opportunities through you know, the fund that was left here in Cuyahoga County through the Cleveland Foundation, there may be an opportunity to apply for that as well.
I think there'll be some federal programs for school, you know, older school kids. And I think somehow it might be good to have a lobbyist sniff that out a little bit to make sure that we may want to apply for something that we could get. And if we could get, let's say, 20 people to help us with the costs that go into that, and some costs for administrating it, that could be very helpful for both the people that are trying to get these kids to work, back to work, and also for us.
We agree.
Let's see, now new business.
We will move into new business. The first action item is 2020 budget adjustment number one. Bill is still on the line with us.
Thank you, Brian. This budget adjustment is for $744,889. This is exclusively provided by new restricted funds. Typically, we do our restricted funds budget adjustment in February of each year, but these are regarding projects that are active right now, getting ready to accelerate. So we want to make sure that we do this timely and appropriately. There is $294,380 for Irishtown Bend, $440,000 for Soaring Eagle Zipline, and $10,509 for Brighton Park. The recommended action is that the Board of Park Commissioners approves this budget adjustment number one for $744,889, as shown on pages 46 to 47 of the agenda.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Next action item is the authorization list revision. This is something we do every year and periodically when we have employee changes. This is for the petty cash fund. It starts on page 13 and follows itself all the way through to the recommended action.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
The next action item is designation of the 2021 legislative consultant. We're recommending a continuation with our relationship with Capital Consulting. We've had many different successes, most recently receiving $800,000 out of the state capital budget. We worked efficiently with Capital Consulting downstate to work on securing funds for the Cleveland Metro Park Zoo, as well as other law changes along the way. So we are recommending the continued relationship with Capital Consulting Group out of Columbus. Recommended action falls on the mid portion of page 20.
Very good partner. Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
The next is the award of RFP 6539B, Construction Manager at Risk for Cleveland Metro Park Zoo Zipline. As the commissioners saw most recently, we advertised the zipline, the Soaring Eagle zipline. We have worked through a short list of contractors through an independent evaluation of the qualifications. We most recently have come out with an award analysis of Regency Construction as the best value. They fall on the bottom portion of page 22 for the recommended action to engage Regency Construction Services for the construction manager for the zipline at Cleveland Metro Park Zoo.
Can I ask just a quick question here, Brian? There are two contracts. One for what our contractor will do, and then one for what the zipline guys will do. They'll supply the steel and all the equipment, and then what participation will they have in putting it all together? In other words, how will these two groups merge financially?
Well, they're separate contracts, obviously. Yeah. One's through, you know, Regency, and one's through the Soaring Eagle Zipline Company. The contract that was approved at the most recent board will, you know, provide the cars, the cables, the electric, the power pad stuff. And then Regency will be basically pouring footers, foundations, getting the pads ready, getting the site prep, and the other things that we'll be responsible for. They'll be also doing the installation in partnership with the Zipline Company.
Okay, I'm with you. Thanks.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
The next action item we have is amendments to management services, waivers of certain management service fees as a result of COVID-19. This is with Dino's at Manakiki, RFP 5970, Dino's at Acacia, RFP 5885, Go Ape High Ropes Course, RFP 5986, and Cleveland Volleyball, Cleveland Plays Volleyball, RFP 6129. Before I kind of go through all of the background, as we know, 2020 was an extremely challenging year. To only have this few of vendors actually coming back to Cleveland Metro Parks to actually look for some relief. As we know, our own zoo was closed for a period of time. Most of our reservables were closed for the entire year. Berwyn's Wharf was closed for 4 months. We have certain contract with Dino's, Go Ape, and Cleveland Volleyball Plays, where we essentially were on notice through the entire year. And then we basically looked at the end of the year, their ability to pay based on the contract and based on a continuation of services to the benefit the park. We know for a fact Go Ape would not have opened had we not done some adjustments throughout the year. Cleveland Plays was kind of in the same boat, and Dino's at Manakiki and Acacia providing the services to our golf course, as you can see, was very clear that we needed to have services at our Manakiki location. So the team diligently worked through a process, which is all designated through the different pages of all the different things that we were doing to have business continuation. And essentially we amended and renegotiated through the process to get to the end.
So I guess in broad brush, what we've done, we've adjusted the contracts, shortened them. So is the end game that we can enter into new contracts at a certain point in the future, or we're just leaving that open-ended?
I think somewhat open-ended. I don't know that anybody actually understands exactly the long-term financial impact of COVID. I can tell you Go Ape numbers actually came up after they got reopened. They put in axe throwing and they were trying to evolve. They had done very well. As things continued along, Acacia and Manakiki both struggled from the banquet side of things, but the golf side of things did fairly well. To your point, Bruce, about the contraction of the contract at Acacia, one of the things very clearly, it's becoming cost prohibitive to do business there. When you look at the amount of events that can be scheduled based on the utilities and the costs that are with it, the facility is almost cost prohibitive. We're actually looking at the opportunity to end the contract early. It was to be to 2023. We're bringing it back to 2021. There could be a reevaluation period and or the concept of actually taking the building down at that point. The challenge we have as a park district is that it would take us over $150,000 a year to operate it just from the utility standpoint alone, which is a really cost prohibitive model for the park district.
Do we have a demo estimate?
We do have a demo estimate of about $300,000. Most of it is in the basement because it is actually sunken all the way in. So there are two different formulas by which that could be used. We would also look to recycle as much as we possibly could out of the facility. I also want to make sure the general public realizes it was a golf course clubhouse. It was not necessarily designed for what it's actually currently being asked to do. There's a tremendous amount of vacant space throughout the entire building that isn't being used. That has to be conditioned and taken care of. We're also looking at the remodel of the old cart barn, increasing the bathrooms in capacity, much as we had talked about early on, and basically shrinking the entire footprint at the facility. It had been long talked about even when we first acquired it, the golf course from the Acacia Country Club through the conservation fund of about taking it down. As the commissioners will remember, we removed the tennis courts, we removed the pool, and that had been conversation at one point in time to take the clubhouse down. However, we tried very diligently to put a concessionaire in there, but it during COVID and everything else, it is becoming cost prohibitive to run that facility.
Is the individual that or the fund that gave us the property, are they pushing still to tear it down?
They have not been in communication for at least a year.
They would be unhappy.
I don't know that they would be unhappy. I think the ultimate goal of that property was to have it as a, you know, Cleveland Metro Parks Park Reservation consistent with our other operations. It just so happened that when we acquired the facility, we happened to have this clubhouse on it.
Yeah, sorry, albatross.
There's one thought. I'm not sure if this makes any sense at all, but the clinic at some point is going to have to walk the walk on being sure that they're doing all they can do to preserve health in the community. And there are all sorts of things that are going on at the clinic to affect that. But one thing that there is not, we have the health museum is sort of part of the natural history museum now, but it would be interesting to have there could be people interested in a museum for health. In other words, a museum that explains how the way the human body was designed is different than the way it's being managed now. That kind of naturalistic approach would it be worthwhile my talking to someone at the clinic about that, or you talking to someone at the clinic about it?
Having looked at the deeds and having negotiated out, I do not believe it would be consistent with the deed restrictions that are currently on the
Fair
facility.
Enough.
So
yeah.
It was either to operate as this type of facility that's currently there or not operate.
Okay.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Rose, but that.
No, that would be accurate.
So we anticipate at some point, either this year or next, where we'd be looking at this blackboard, what the downside is for maintaining operation and it's cost effective to raise it.
Absolutely. It's the sum total of both, depending on how business gets back to some level of normalcy. If there's ability to continue to pay on the facility, we have had significant issues in the building, including trying to cool the building effectively.
So this basically may have created an opportunity.
Yeah.
This has created an opportunity to remove a facility that is not necessarily serving the general public in the best fashion for that particular park reservation.
But there are events scheduled for this year for 2021.
Correct. That we are working contractually to fulfill to the best of Dino's ability and Cleveland Metro Park's ability. So the recommended action falls on the bottom portion of page 26 to work with Dino's at Manakiki, Dino's at Acacia, Go Ape, and Cleveland Plays.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
The next action item we have is the authorization of an acquisition. We will hopefully be able to bring up a picture of it. This is the French Street LTD property. This is part of Rivergate. This is a property that most recently came to Cleveland Metro Parks within the last 45 plus days. We have been noticed that our current lease has been assumed by a new company where our current maintenance operations are off of Columbus Road. They would continue it for a period of time. However, they made it known to us that the current structure, the way the building is where we are currently in, may not be there for the long term. Having said that, with the amount of complexity, the amount of trails that have come on board between not only Heritage Park 1, the onset of Canal Basin Park, the work that's going on at Irishtown Bend, the trails that have continued all the way to West 65th Street, and then all the way to the lakefront, it is imperative that we have a facility down in this area to be able to maintain the parks and the trails. In late 2020, Greg and Barb Scott came to Cleveland Metro Parks, gave us a call, and indicated their interest in selling this property at 1045 French Street and 1725 Fall Street. Cleveland Metro Parks has worked very diligently to purchase and acquire this in a fee simple manner for a 0.6 acre parcel of land with two buildings on it for the purchase price of $1 million. Again, this will be the maintenance facility for this particular area. It ties very strategically into our land. It's right next to it. To be able to find a piece of property down there was, well, very lucky.
Yeah.
If there are no questions, the recommended action falls on the mid portion of page 27 to acquire this in a fee simple fashion for 0.6 acres.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
We will go into the tabulation of award and bids, commodity uses report, sole source, and Ohio Co-op for tires. Recommended action falls on the top portion of page 28.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
We will go to vouchers and payroll. I don't know if Bill's still on. In an effort of expediency, it is resolution number 21-01-001 for the approval of vouchers and payroll.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Public comment, is that all, Brian, anything else you want to add? Public comments, please.
Okay, we have Marty for public comments. And Marty, I will go ahead and unmute you and give it a shot, see if we can hear you, please. Try again, please.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. It hits, pardon me, it hits close to home when Dennis Durbin, a former Metro Parks employee, dies waiting for EMS. Ambulance was delayed due to botched dispatch by to Grand Valley Dispatch. CVD, which you chose, in spite of questions, to replace your in-house Metro Parks dispatch. Perfectly clear information was given to CVD with repeated emphasis on the correct city and an area CVD has covered for some time and should know. In spite of that, CVD chose to ignore what they were told. As a result, it took 14 minutes for help to arrive, and that was too late. Sacrificing those critical moments in what certainly you'd want for yourself, your family, and your Metro Parks visitors. This does not bode well going forward with CVD covering unfamiliar areas like Metro Parks and Western Cuyahoga. Big outlays today, too, for the zip line and all its promised revenues. Time will tell. GoApe was a previous favorite with Axe Rowing recently added. As noted previously, GoApe experienced falling revenue and attendance each year prior to 2020, in spite of employee discounts and free advertising from Metro Parks. If it were merely the impact of COVID, then there would be no need to slash the guaranteed minimum beyond 2021, as is being done. Separately, did we ever recover the losses from Oak Island Consulting? As with COVID challenges, staff really stepped up to make 2019's winter lights work, but you have to wonder if Oak Island was all that they claimed. Optimism for new projects, consultants is fine, but that optimism needs tempered with real past experience. Proper planning prevents poor performance. Tax revenues actually grew, as did grants, with revenue losses offset by salary cuts. All in all, Metro Parks did very well thanks to much personal sacrifice by your employees. Hopefully 2021 will be better for all. Thank you.
Thank you, Marty.
Just a clarification on Oak Island. That was the contractor at the Wild Winter Lights last year and who walked off the job on November 9th, 11 days before the show was to open. And due to the hard work of our staff, we put the show on. And actually, we didn't pay Oak Island anything. We recovered all of the revenue from that event.
Net, net, we came out okay?
Yes.
We paid Oak Island nothing. We took all of the revenues. We settled everything. We returned everything that was no longer the property of Cleveland Metro Parks, and we walked away from that deal. Also to add, I'm not sure where Marty is going with, you know, adding and consulting and those other things. There are very few consulting contracts that actually go through Cleveland Metro Parks. If they are, they're for engineering and very technical services across the board. So I'm not sure where that continued insinuation is.
What's the comment about dispatch?
I don't know. I honestly, I don't know anything about a 14-minute call time. I don't know. I mean, you know, there are many municipalities that we're covering at this point in time. So if she has some specific claim to it, I'm not currently aware of any.
Right. It sounds like it was from a different city. It wasn't us, but it was a city that CVD served. So sure, we're open to hearing that information that she has.
Okay.
It wasn't. Was it one of our employees?
It sounds like a former employee.
Okay. Okay. I missed that.
That passed away.
Yes. That's what she's saying.
Again, I'm not.
I don't have any personal knowledge of this case, but we're interested in learning about it.
I will also say, in general, I mean, 2020 and 2021 have been challenging from a COVID standpoint. I can tell you, numerous Cleveland Metro Parks employees have had the virus and had to be out for a period of time. So when you look at the ability to have business continuation at the very highest levels, each and every organization is trying to do their best possible job. I can only imagine that CVD is trying to give the best possible information. Is there an opportunity for a mistake? Absolutely there is. So I can't speak to it. I don't know what exactly happened, but all I know is that from the transition from when we started to where we are now, they are doing a very good job for Cleveland Metro Parks. And I also will again state, those are Cleveland Metro Parks. They were Cleveland Metro Parks employees that are still dispatching for Cleveland Metro Parks. I don't know why that seems to get lost in the mix.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's see, information briefings.
Just one, was that the last public comment, David?
No further.
Very good. All right, we'll move into information briefing items. Johnson's Creek Restoration Project. Sean McDermott will give us an update on where we're at with our project at Johnson's Creek in Hinckley. Sean, welcome to 2021.
Hi, Sean.
Oh, thank you. Good morning, everyone. How are you?
Good morning.
Great to see you. Great to be here in 2021. So commissioners, this morning I'm going to give you a quick update on our Johnson's Creek Restoration Project. We are in Hinckley Reservation. We are in the southern part of the reservation. Johnson's Creek is a tributary to the east branch of the Rocky River, which is dammed to form Hinckley Lake. So Johnson's Creek flows directly into Hinckley Lake in the south end. The creek itself is, it serves a majority undeveloped area. It is a very high quality stream, if you will, in terms of how you compare it against our streams throughout the entire park district, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't have its own unique set of challenges. So we have some issues relative to fish passage, say that five times fast, because of a culvert under West Drive. We've got some disconnected floodplain that has started to form and some stream bank erosion by the Johnson's Creek picnic area. Now we can ask ourselves, why are these things happening when the majority of the tributary area and the catchment is undeveloped? You know, there's many different reasons. We've got geology in play. In May of 2014, we saw the intensity of a storm here that we don't know that we've ever seen before and that we may ever see again. It was one of the most intensive, up to 7 inches in a very short period of time of rain. And we are still recovering from some of those issues there. So we put together some analysis. We put together a plan that shows where we'd like to concentrate improvements on Johnson's Creek, making sure that we at the same time take into consideration West Drive, the trail system around the creek itself, replacing the box culvert under the drive itself, connecting to floodplain and making sure that we also protect that existing bridle trail. This area does get a lot of bridle use, equestrian use, and we're very, very cognizant of that.
So effectively, we're intercepting all of this sedimentation outflow.
We are, and that is both the goal of the Johnson's Creek Restoration Project, and we'll have an update to you on Hinckley Dam in about a month or two, which will include some details on how we're going to dredge the lake and actually create a forebay in the lake to catch further sediment from the upstream inflow into the lake. We've done a lot of due diligence on Johnson's Creek itself. Natural Resources and their staff has done some incredible work here. They have surveyed the entire creek for what we call the BHI internally. That's our Bank Erosion Hazard Index. They looked at over 13,000 feet of stream, concentrating on about 650 feet of it, which has been impacted. No coincidence, that's our project area. We also looked specifically at fish species and whether or not fish can pass that culvert under West Drive. You can see here that down by the lake, the lower portions, we've got 24 total fish species. Downstream of the culvert, upstream of the culvert, 7. So you can pretty quickly deduce what's going on there with that culvert.
So in that case, would you just have sort of rubble instead of where it drops off quickly?
So we're going to do two things. Actually, I'll walk you through them here. We're going
to
restore.
Mr. Moore was already trying to design.
Yes. We like it. We like it. we're going to restore that 650 feet of stream using a natural channel design, that grade control in the stream bed. So we're going to reconnect, we're going to bring that stream bed up, connect it better to the floodplain. And to your point, Commissioner Moore, that box culvert, we are going to replace it to enable fish passage. One of the reasons that there is a drop-off at the end of the culvert is actually because it is undersized. So the velocities pick up and they scour. So that's the issue there. We will fix that. And because it's undersized, floods currently, they top out onto West Drive. So we're looking to reduce that issue now. And then we want to build in resiliency to the project. So as we work on our designs, bring back a more resilient stream so that when we do have these severe storms, we can.
Have you done this before where we've sort of redesigned nature?
We have. And the best example is Euclid Creek in Acacia. And it is now in its.
Apart from that, that's. Okay.
Yes, and we have done it on much smaller scales too. We're learning a lot on how best to do this. Natural Resources has a great, Jen Greiser, the Director of Natural Resources.
So I mean, with studying the hydraulics and how this works, when you say anticipating future events, all of that stuff going into it's pretty sophisticated.
It is sophisticated. It's a little bit of a swag, if you will. Even when we're looking at Garfield Pond and designing Garfield Pond for the future, we don't know exactly what climate change will bring. So
laboratory work.
It is laboratory work, and we put some additional yields. We try to be as conservative as we can.
And we'll do it. We'll put a track loader or a track loader out down there and just sort of begin to massage the. Is that the idea, or are we hiring contractors?
We will actually hire a design build team. We'll be back to you in a month with that recommendation to bring the team on board. With that, we are really pushing, and we think the right way to do these stream restorations
is creating our own manual in the long run.
We are, and the basis of that is really this natural channel design.
Yeah,
we're not looking to harden streams like was done in the 60s, 70s, and 80s with, you know, concrete, rock walls, gabions. We're looking to bring in natural features like deadfall, root wads, things of that nature that then help naturally build up the stream banks, and we're not hardening them. That's one of the sins of the past that we're trying to get beyond, and really cool. We're really pushing the boundaries here in some of the things.
Could we do it ourselves? In other words, could we have a contractor plan it out, maybe with help of a lot of other people, but then with our own manpower, our own machines.
Today we're journeymen, tomorrow we're craftsmen.
No, but is this right, or are we going to let it out as a contract?
This specific one is, I'm going to go back real quick, is about just under about a $500,000 project. So we feel it's best to bring on the experts, the design build team. We will learn from them so that in the future we could potentially progress to doing smaller projects ourselves. We are still likely to possibly do the culvert ourselves because we really want an expert in that natural channel design and construction. We know that we can do culverts. We don't want to pay someone who doesn't do that every day. So we'll work out those details. But we are learning, our trades are learning, our site crew is learning.
If you could make it smaller, mm-hmm. So you contract out the first part and then you learn so you can do part two yourself, I think that would be, it's much more economical to do it yourself.
Are you sure?
Oh, I mean, in something like this, you got
to. No. I mean, to split up this project, is it better?
Well, I think it's better because you learn, and then you can get more out of a dollar's worth of labor later. I mean, I'll bet it's twice the cost of hiring, a firm to do it. And we need to learn about how to do this ourselves. There are a lot of other streams around.
We will.
I think we've done a lot of those examples, and it great is. You know, we've done Huntington bathrooms. We use a contractor for part of the work, and our teams did the rest of the work. So we actually have got this very blended approach throughout Metro Parks. This is kind of a unique one. You know, the box culvert at West, is failing, so we need to replace that. So, you know, we've done some of this work. We actually had a team when the cement joints were, we actually took an auger and drilled all the way through. So we've got very resourceful people, but I think partnerships like this are extremely important. And getting this right is so important for the overall health of Hinkley Lake. When we do the dredge and we do the other work, we want to make sure that the material that's there is staying out of the lake. So I think we need to be very cautious as to how we're approaching this to make sure that it gets done the right way.
But we're still taking notes.
Absolutely.
Yes, we are. And we're, I'd say we're in the public realm, we're leading the industry, if you will, in how we're approaching these things. Yeah. And the sewer district is always a great partner. In this one, we've got Rocky River Watershed Council. So really quick, where we are today. We've issued requests for qualifications. We will shortlist. We're actually performing that function this afternoon. We're going to review everyone who submitted. We'll then release a request for proposal. That'll be next week. And then we'll be back to you in February to recommend the award of a contract so we can start design with the design build contractor. Take us a little bit to permit and design and then start construction in January of 22. Again, our partners here are Rocky River Watersheds Council, who is operated by Cuyahoga Soil and Water, even though we are in Hinckley Township in Medina County.
And we've already received that grant, or that's something we're still applying for?
We have already received the Ohio EPA 319 grant that is awarded. Yes.
That's terrific.
Yep. Thank you.
The Sean Show will continue. We will move into From Streams to Bridges, things that go over.
Thank you, Brian. So From Streams to Bridges, this project, I want to be very clear, is not ours. So this is a project that we have known for some time is going to be advancing. I just want the big preface there that we are a stakeholder and the Cuyahoga County is rebuilding Hilliard Bridge. And in that, they have been very good at communicating with us.
Is this a redesign or just a re?
It is a new, it is a replacement. So yeah. we'll walk you through the whole gamut here.
Okay.
So Hilliard Bridge, this is in Rocky River Reservation. Most people see Hilliard Bridge from I-90. But the bridge itself certainly predated the interstate system. Crossing the Rocky River, connecting Lakewood to Rocky River, the city of Rocky River itself.
That's a great picture.
So Judy McKeegan was kind enough to dig up some.
It's a white truck on the left.
White Motor Company, there you go.
Made here in Cleveland.
So here is a photo just after opening, around about 1926. This was a major connection for Lakeshore suburbs. And the unique thing here was the bridge itself actually never reached the capacity that it was planned to because I-90 would come along yeah. in about 40 years, 35 years, and somewhat supplant it. But nonetheless, Metro Parks and the bridge have a unique relationship in that William Stinchcomb had come from the county, county engineer, and this was very early in the Metro Parks history, just a mere 7 years after the adoption, the official adoption of the park district. So with that, the board at the time in January of 1924 had some very specific language.
Just the architectural, got it, thank you.
There you go. So the board expressed an inclination to file no claim. So they did not ask for payment for the right for the county to build a bridge over the park. They wanted input into the architectural and the structural appropriateness of the bridge, and they wanted to have specific say in where the piers would be located. That all happened.
Can we do that again?
That's why we're here. We're just starting the process. So here's what I wanted to show you so we're all aware of how history has transgressed here. This is the photo taken when the parkway was being developed, looking south.
Great.
And what has changed is you can see the view shed is completely changed. We did not have the controls over the federal government once the interstate system came through in the 60s. And with the very large bridge deck of I-90, the view shed there has been modified drastically. I had never seen this picture before. Judy found this one.
That's great.
Again, looking south. And compare it to today with I-90, it is different. A important note here is that ODOT will be replacing the I-90 bridge as well in about 10 years. So planning for that is just about ready to start. And again, we have zero ability to give input in terms of architecture anyways on that bridge replacement. Okay, so looking down, we've got Hilliard Bridge here. And I-90 to the top. Today, Hilliard carries about 11,000 vehicles a day. I-90 about 116,000. So a very, very big difference between volumes. That'll come up in a bit. The bridge itself is deteriorating and deteriorating quickly. You can see here just the exposed rebar in 2013, and then advancing on to 2018. These are very expensive, very large pieces of infrastructure to maintain, very challenging. Because of that, they have put netting under the bridge. Not only have they put netting, but they have also, we've worked with them, this is about 8 years ago or now, we've actually rerouted portions of the all-purpose trail because of the concrete issues and chunks of concrete falling onto the trail. So here is where the trail is today that diverts that span. And here's where the trail was. So we've had to actively work around this issue and work with the county. They are going through or have gone through an alternatives analysis, all the way from doing nothing, which really isn't much of an alternative, all the way through rehabbing, removal and replacement, and then on the same alignment and removal and emplacement on a new alignment, they have arrived at the removal and replacement on the same alignment, which is good. It means more of a shutdown period for reconstruction, but it means less impact in terms of real estate and less impact to the park itself. They are looking at, and these numbers are a little bit old here, but they are looking at about a $40 million project. And in this, they hope to get at least 75 years out of a new bridge. We have a lot of work left to do with them on what this new bridge looks like, but they did this when they went through this alternative analysis and compared what it would be if they were to rebuild the bridge. And their thinking is that not only would it cost more, but they would only get 25 years. And you know, we can challenge these things if we really wanted to, but again, this is not our project, so we want to be deliberate in the response and feedback that we give. So
why do you think only 20
instead of all the
I'm sorry, Commissioner, I didn't hear.
Well, what was
mimic
the question?
The trussing.
Excuse me?
Mimic the old trussing but using steel, so it's more streamlined, but with I mean, is that going to be part of the discussion? You just don't know yet.
It potentially could be. There is a limit to the funding that the county has. They're trying to stay at about 40 million. Our first initial reaction was do what was done at Fulton. And because that has come out beautifully.
Yeah, wonderful, yeah.
That was a post-tension concrete arch bridge, and it's expensive. I mean, we're talking a lot of dollars here. So that's where we're trying to balance,
yeah.
You know, what rights do we have? How much input do we give? Where does that end? So we're starting the process. That's why we're bringing this to you now, because it's going to be a lot of conversations.
Is there a marketing component here that would make any sense if there's a gap to fill that other entities or public may want to contribute if there's really an understanding of what the aesthetic impact might be?
Quite possibly. The reason we're coming here to you today is because that public output process that the county is administering is about to start. So we didn't want you to find out.
We do some of that marketing.
Potentially, we could. I think that we need to have a clear understanding of what it is we're asking for. There has been.
Oh, no, I'm sorry to interrupt. I get that, but I think that historically, that was the quid pro quo that the park negotiated for the original structure. Mm-hmm. In lieu of hard cash, it's like just designed it to something that works with the environment. Now, I-90 is a different, but if we can make this one have some aesthetic integrity, you know, some architectural beauty, mm-hmm. that would seem then to provide a platform for the redesign of I-90 as well. So ultimately, you could get cousins up there.
Agreed.
Kissing cousins.
Getting back to this point a little more, rehab two, if you did those with steel arches,
that's what I would.
Is it just ridiculous, or is that worth talking about? I mean, because I would think you could. The arches are almost the same. And so you'd have six arches that are almost the same. And then the big issue is the structure above it.
Right.
I wouldn't say that it's ridiculous. I think it's certainly very doable. The question is, what is that impact to cost? And if that is a comment that we want to bring forward to the engineering team, we can absolutely do it. It is likely that, because watching the Innerbelt project and how that evolved, and knowing that they went from some pretty aspirational designs to maybe things that are a little bit more basic, There's costs associated with every custom piece of being restored.
I think we get all that, but I guess the question is it worth trying to mimic, in other words, with a more state-of-the-art material, but kind of mimic the design and then benchmark? Maybe that's a benchmark. In other words, it'll be north of the budget, but if there's a gap, that's where I'm going with it, because if we can illustrate it where people can see it's not just aspirational, it's doable. If so, I know it's wishful thinking, but I think that's kind of,
well, yeah, there's kind of two ways, I guess, we can look at this, because the county's aware that currently we haven't even got to the architectural discussions yet. So let me walk you through something, because what they're looking to do is, I would say, cooperative, in that they're not just looking to say, hey, we're going to slap back this bridge and you're going to take what you get. They're talking to us, they're talking to Lakewood, they're talking to Rocky River, and in doing so, there's also this community confluence plan that's going on right now between all of those parties.
Who's going to lead the design decision making, and who could influence it best?
Yeah, your previous slide said that there would be public input. I mean, I would imagine the public would all want, since we have a very attractive bridge out there.
Yeah, I mean, that's like the reservation people flock to.
It seems like we need a better number, like to really understand what's doable and how much more it is. And then to Bruce's point, is there a way to help raise dollars or bring money to the table to?
I mean, we might elevate consciousness, I guess, as community perception.
The thing that's interesting here, I think, Sean, is that the bridge fiasco we just got through, you know, the bridge to Windy Park, that was a 30-year project. And most of that time was taken with complete nonsense. In other words, people were there were people that were suggesting things that were completely impractical. Now, I think making the bridge look good, there's a step that comes before even introducing that idea, and that is trying to understand what it would be if you made this out of structural steel. I mean, I know you can't make it out of concrete. There's no one in the United States now. Everyone's scared to death of pre-stressed shapes, you know, and it just, the workmen aren't there, and there's a whole sorts of issues. It's much easier to slap in a piece of steel, big wide beam, and do it that way. So I'd just be curious of if we could get any economics on what it would cost to make it more attractive. I know I'm talking on just the opposite argument that I did with Whiskey Island, but in this case, you know, it is an icon. The bridge is beautiful, and you sort of hate to wreck it.
This is great feedback that we will take back to the county and let them know the feelings of the board.
But the immediate thing they're going to say is they're going to say that the economics are bad. But if we did a little bit of spade work on what some of these arches would cost, and then the difficulty of springing up from the arch to the road surface, it might be interesting.
Well, you're absolutely correct. And we are early enough in the process that we can interject thoughts, opinions, stances, and they have to go through their federal NEPA process, the National Environmental Protection Act.
Just telling that story, I don't want to obsess about it, but the fact that the park board back then consciously, deliberately chose to forego just compensation under the Constitution and said, here's what we want. We want in-kind value. Because value can be dollars and cents. That's basically what traditional eminent domain does. But so many times you close that gap by coming up with something that really delivers the value. And I think the more we can tell the story historically of the metro parks in the last 100 years going forward, we've talked about it at the centennial. This is one of those things that could be emblematic in telling that story, that the value far surpasses the dollar calculation. The whole is greater than the sum of the parts if we can accomplish it. So I think it comes down to if there's a way to design it that we think can be feasible, even if it surpasses the mark that currently is there. And the more we get all these players thinking that that's doable, it's achievable, it's not just fanciful. The sooner we plant that seed, I think the better. And it would make sense that the metro parks do that because it's so consistent with our values.
But on the flip side, there's no argument that can be made that they would have to pay now since they're building a completely new bridge if it's going in the same place. If they need to move the footers, if do we have any rights? Not that we would charge them, but at least to use that as a lever.
I think they already acquired the air rights. I'm not sure that there's any other, unless they're changing the alignment, and they're not, because that's happened in the Interbelt. They had to adjust. There are some very nice property valuations that resulted from that, I can tell you firsthand. But it's a good question, but I suspect that.
Do you know the answer?
That ship is.
Commissioner Berry, we are, sorry, Gross.
You know, that might be best answered in executive session as we study the legal issues.
Sorry.
That's okay.
But we will be going through a full process of what rights exist.
It just seems to me this is something that the public could. It's different, but it's not inconsistent.
Agreed. So to the county's credit, let's take the architecture and aesthetics issue off the table for just one second. They are openly, collaboratively discussing with Rocky River, who's got a very aggressive master plan for Hilliard Boulevard. They want to remove half of the boulevard on the south side between the river and Worcester Road here and turn it into an all-purpose trail.
Wow.
That is fantastic, right? And then Lakewood is investing in bike lanes on Hilliard to connect.
It all fits.
So the bridge then becomes this very important link. And in the county right now, we're working through with them all these different lane configurations. And with South being on your right, right now we're actually talking to them about putting an all-purpose trail and a sidewalk on the bridge, not having contraflow cycle tracks, actually making it an all-purpose trail, connecting it to what Rocky River is doing, better connecting it to what Lakewood is doing. So they are committing to these type of improvements. And then furthermore, our big push here is to get folks down the valley, down Hogsback. We've got some geotech issues there. We've got access issues. So long-term, we want to improve that and to the bridge and to the connection on Riverside.
At the respective bridgeheads, are they looking to the two communities at sort of future development potential that plays off of these pedestrian components?
Rocky River absolutely is, especially they've got more potential on the south side of Hilliard.
I mean, this is, we're not talking Tiger Grant, but we're talking analogous type of redevelopment strategies that aren't just some aesthetic, some park fluffy, that looks nice, feels good, but actually translates into economic return for the dollar.
So,
and I think that's part of the marketing strategy that both communities certainly would embrace as well as the county.
Agreed, and to your point exactly, Rocky River's master plan calls for targeted redevelopment on the south side of Hilliard against the valley. The interesting thing is, you know, we are always looking at our deed restrictions because some proposals have gone against the deed restrictions we hold on several of these properties. So it's this great balancing act, but the city's been a great partner. And
would this project include narrowing Hilliard then to the west along with the bridge, or is it just the bridge that would happen and that's all a future idea?
It's the latter. The bridge would happen, and if the city could line up the funds, great. But we want to plan it so that it.
The scope of project is what we're talking about.
Yeah. Scope of project is the bridge.
Got it.
This project, but I'm saying scope of the larger project for the community and the county. This is the inset in the map, but.
Correct.
Again, I think, I don't want to overuse the word marketing, but I think if the community at large understanding is that this has other components to it, that this is critical, this is the immediate critical path decision, but these are going to follow. It's like phase one, two, and three. They need to cohere, they need to be synchronized in some way.
Absolutely correct, yes. Walk you through where we are. So Cuyahoga County Public Works is going to commence public input very soon. They have a full environmental review to go through, have to go through that right-of-way clearance process, then engineering, They want to be in a bidding timeframe in November of 22 and then start construction sometime in 23 through 26.
Yeah, I know we're not talking aesthetics, but that's amazing.
That's a, I mean, that right there, that's.
Yeah.
Do you want to lose that or do you want to figure out a way to make it?
That's emblematic of the park system.
Yes.
I mean, I think if you looked at it, you took off, took the left brain hat off completely and just thought about how you could do it, preserving some of those ideas, I think that would be terrific. I mean, just to find out what an arch would cost.
I think it's our responsibility.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm worried too about that 25-year lifespan. That just seems, I don't know, amazing to me that they're truly saying that that's the difference. It, you know, given as long as the current bridge has lasted and.
What do you know about engineering?
It just.
But there, you know, this concrete has spalled off. So.
But it's well over 25 years. I mean, to say that you would build a new bridge.
You spent $60 million and only, yeah.
Yeah, well, and it would only last 25 years. I just find that.
I would agree that trying to fix a spalled con, you know, where the rebar is.
But I have to believe with materials today, you could,
yes, that's
you
exactly
could achieve
where I'm
something.
Going. And again, this current bridge has lasted well over 25 years.
Can you go back to the shot where you're showing the yeah, that one right there.
So
if you had a nice steel arch,
that's a poster shot,
and could figure out how you connect the road surface to the bottom of the, you know, to the bottom part of the arch. See those and have it so it flexes the right amount. You know, it's steel, not concrete, so it's a little bit different flexing. So the surface of the road would be changed. I mean, if you could get some of these rough numbers together so someone can, so they can say, well, the art in that is this many million. And the art would be comparing it to the bridge behind it, you know, the stuff, just steel, one steel piece.
Mm-hmm. We will take all this feedback to the county and go from there. Thank you.
Get Kelly involved.
Thank you, Sean. We will move into the next info item if you want to let Harold know. Harold is coming in. This is the 2020 strategic plan priorities review. As we know, COVID basically forced us into an unknown situation throughout 2020. Navigating the challenge caused by COVID-19 took a significant toll on not only the citizens, but it was a very historic time in the park system. We basically are looking at how we use the mission and the vision of the park district, the strategic priorities, and we're just providing a review of 2020 from the strategic planning process, which is also part of our CAPRA accreditation process. Harold?
Welcome, Harold.
Good morning. How's
Happy
everyone
New Year,
doing?
Harold.
How's everyone doing?
Good.
Dave, are you going to move the...
I think he sanitized for you, too.
Oh, that's good. So 2020, from a pandemic perspective, I want to kind of address some of the things that were done in the organization to get us through the pandemic. And it goes without saying that it was a trying year. We as an organization did very well in terms of kind of maneuvering through those things that a lot of organizations struggle with. Everyone was blindsided by the pandemic. You know, one day we were here, next day we weren't, and so we took it as an opportunity to improve some of the organizational effectiveness across the board. So I want to go back to 2012, and Brian will remember this. That was when the $12 million was taken from us overnight by the governor. He came into office and he said, I'm taking $12 million away. And I recall sitting in the room with Brian. It was the Overlook room at the time, but now it's his conference room, that we sat there and looked at one another and said, so what are we going to do? We were relatively new to the organization. What emerged from that conversation was a philosophy that I think sort of kind of carried on year to year, year to year from that point on. We looked at it as a crisis and we said, we're not going to waste this crisis. We're going to make some improvements and take it on as a challenge. Same thing holds true in 2020. I think as an organization, we looked at it as a crisis. And we knew that we had to find a way to get through it. And so I just want to give a lot of kudos to the organization, the employees, the community, for stepping up and helping us through this crisis. It was a joint effort in terms of us getting through the crisis. The presentation that you have in front of you, we sort of looked at some of the things that we did in 2020 and tied them or put them in the buckets that that's related to the Centennial Plan. So back a few years ago, and it was refreshed, I think, in 15, don't quote me, but it was refreshed in 15. And so we want to look at how this played out in 2020. So the first thing that changed quite a bit was how we met with one another in 2020. So this changed overnight. I recall we had to switch to a virtual type of meeting concept. The chiefs of the organization, I don't recall how long, but it was long. Was it a month or two that we met every morning at 9 o'clock? So I consider that our huddle every morning at 9 o'clock. And because of we were trying to build a plane and fly it at the same time, that huddle, there were audibles throughout the day, the play changed throughout the day, everything, we had to huddle again in the afternoon to make sure that we were all on the same page. Then you had the daily briefings that everyone in Ohio, they were glued to at 2 o'clock, listening to the governor and some of us not listening to Dr. Acting telling us how this was going to play out, and it did play out just as she stated throughout the ordeal. As a side note, a little humor to this, I look forward to Governor DeWine's presentations because I got a glimpse of his tie collection, which he commented on every day. And also I found out what Fran was cooking because it was either chicken soup or sort of jam or preserve that she made over the weekend. So I got a glimpse of his diet and some of the recipes that were in his house throughout the presentation.
Your own COVID relief.
So after we put a plan in place, you saw that we had to adjust as an organization. And this is a glimpse of some of the pictures of the staff that went out and did their jobs during a pandemic. And so again, I want to give kudos to the entire staff because it's part of the DNA, I believe, at Cleveland Metro Parks. It's part of the culture at Cleveland Metro Parks. And again, I think it started back in 2012. You have a culture, a lot of times you can't really pinpoint what it is until something goes wrong. Mm. And then you see people step up and meet the needs of the community. So I'm going to talk about a couple of the strategic priorities. I want to give an opportunity to some of my peers to come in as well and kind of touch on some of the things they were doing, because I don't know everything. I think they would be a better source of information when it comes to how they maneuvered through this ordeal. So organizational sustainability. And again, throughout this presentation, you will see comment boxes on the side. And this is feedback that we were receiving from the community throughout the pandemic. And one of the things I want to highlight is you can't put a number, you can't put a dollar amount on the health, mental health, and the physical health that we provided to the community as a whole. They were able to get out and do some things that they wouldn't normally have the opportunity to do because everything was closed. So we can talk about numbers all day long, but I think that's one thing I want to highlight that you can't put a number around. So the first thing I want to touch on is the grants and donations. It is my understanding that we did very well in terms of grants and donations. The community was very supportive of Cleveland Metro Parks. Natalie and her staff were working diligently throughout the year. That's impressive. If you look at $6 million in grants and donations, support or donor support, and $4.6 million in grants awarded during the pandemic year. The next thing is the IT department, which is the foundation of everything, in my opinion, from a technology standpoint. They had to pivot on a dime and make sure that we were able to communicate, we were able to bring services to the community that we normally would provide face-to-face. There was a lot of virtual meetings and virtual events that took place in 2020 that, quite frankly, were very well received by the community.
Just as an example, Maryland National Capital, a peer organization that's won 5 gold medals, basically had 99% desktops. Wow. They had almost no capacity for remote ability. They were actually taking computers from used Chromebooks from high schools and repurposing them for their own staff to try to get themselves online. So that is not lost on the fact that we were literally up and running in less than a week across
that's huge. That's huge.
So we did not miss a beat, and all while managing cybersecurity, because cybersecurity was such a huge problem, because as people tended to go remote, logins and passwords and all the other things, the team hit a home run. Plus, we turned over CVD, we did tons of different upgrades through software, Sentiment, they built a whole entire program. I mean, we cannot say enough things about our IT department here.
I believe it.
And so the CARES Act, and I won't get into a lot of details about the federal relief that was provided, but you've heard Bill from time to time state that we weren't eligible for a lot of that money. There's some pockets of things that we were able to tap into, but overall, we weren't eligible. They specifically carved out park districts in certain parts of the legislation. One part of it was the FMLA law that went into effect as part of the CARES Act, where the government stated that we had to provide 80 hours of FMLA hours, paid FMLA hours. Now, the difference is governments weren't reimbursed, but private sector organizations were. They could apply for reimbursement of those hours. So if you take in consideration that there was about 8,500 hours that employees accessed over the course of 10 months or 9 months that we had to pay for. So that equated to about $250,000 that people were taking off for legitimate reasons. They were either exposed or came down with the coronavirus. But that was one expense that should not go unnoticed, because that was a cost to the organization. That was lost productivity, lost time with the organization.
So 8,500 hours.
8,500 hours.
So what's that in dollar terms?
It was about $250,000, depending on, you know, it's based on what a person makes. So if they took off 80 hours, it's different for someone that makes $20, different for someone that makes $30. But we looked at the totality of it. It was about $250,000 that we had to spend on leave based on not being reimbursed by the federal government. The $8.6 million that you see highlighted there, you've heard Bill use that number from time to time. That was a savings, and it was a variety of ways that we were able to do that. One of the main ways is the Shared Work Ohio. We were one of the first government agencies in Northeast Ohio to access that program. And basically what that allowed us to do is determine furloughs for employees. So we had anywhere between 50% and 10% employees being off from work. So that was a savings for us because of the salary savings. But we were able to access some monies from the federal government. The unemployment costs associated with that was fully reimbursable. So we received a reimbursement for the unemployment parts of that. So if a person was off 10%, there's an unemployment cost from 10% to 100% that we did not have to pay, because we were able to access that through the federal government, federal programs. Position management, we didn't fill any positions, or very few positions during the pandemic. Also, you've heard Brian and Bill talk about the seasonals. We hired very few seasonals. Early on, we didn't hire any seasonals, but towards the middle of the year, meaning June, July, we did bring on a few seasonals. However, we did receive a grant to do that. So we reduced some of our costs in that respect as well. And also the reallocation of existing staff. So our goal was to make sure that the staff, we kept our staff, and we did not lay off staff based on this. We were able to minimize the impact based on some of the programs that we were able to access, but we were also able to reallocate staff to other areas. So taking golf, for instance, they had a banner year, but there were a number of employees in other departments that were reassigned to golf to help out during their busy times. In fact, it wasn't, I think it was around June that I volunteered my kids that they needed to go out there and volunteer at golf. So every week, twice a week, you saw them on the driving range at Shawnee Hills cleaning the golf range. And you saw me there on Sundays too. It's very therapeutic to go out there on Sundays and see a job from start to finish. You clean the driving range and then you move on. Again, the staff was very accommodating. In HR, we were, I guess you could consider us like a temporary agency because we had to monitor and keep track of all of that, the movement of people, where they were, the hours. And so the HR staff stepped up and did a really nice job in that perspective as well. Protection, 24,000 acres. I want to give Rose's team kudos. We exceeded 24,000 acres in 2020. And 2,781, remember that number? That is the number of acres that have been acquired under Brian's leadership. So over the course of 10 years, he has acquired, led the organization down a path of acquiring 2,781 acres. So that's impressive, especially when you compare that to other CEOs of the organization.
Right, it's second only to William Stinchpomp.
There you go. So I want to turn it over to Joe Rozak at this point so he can talk about relevancy. There's some parts and pieces to relevancy that Joe and Chris are going to touch on, and it's some good information. Do you have any questions for me before I step away?
Great job. Thank you.
Yes.
Good morning, Joe. Happy New Year.
Good morning, Joe.
Happy New Year.
What's up?
I wanted to take this time to really focus on our education team. As Harold mentioned, a lot of staff had to pivot and help out in other areas, and the education team really had to pivot a lot in the beginning. Helping out golf or helping out at the boathouse, they were really doing non-traditional jobs and experiencing furloughs, and they really did what they had to do to help out the agency. One of the things, however, that they could do is a lot of the virtual programming. So things like Facebook Live were very popular in the beginning when the pandemic first hit. And a couple of quick stats, we did over 220 live videos in coordination with the zoo as well. And we have nearly 6 million impressions and over 400,000 engagements. So that started almost immediately in March. A lot of other folks were doing virtual programming, and I think our Facebook Lives really kept the community engaged with Cleveland Metro Parks early on when things were so confusing. I know we changed the time, I think, from 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock one of the weeks, and I started to get all these calls like, what happened? What's going on? I had a plan. And so we realized how important those programs were to the community, and people were literally planning their days around them with their families and their children to watch some of that educational programming. As we started to get through the summer, and it was clear that things really weren't going to get better, a lot of school districts started to reach out to us and engage us and say, how can you help us? As they started to realize they were going to be doing mostly virtual programming, especially in the first semester. We were invited to join the CLE for Sci program through Cleveland Metropolitan School District, and we were able to put together some virtual programming for middle school students, so grades 6 through 8, all pre-recorded, 3-part series. It's going to be part of all of their curriculum, so we have the potential now to reach over 6,000 middle school students in CMSD. So we're really proud of that. We were able to receive a couple grants, about $50,000 total in grants. We created kind of a faux studio in one of our facilities and did some pre-recorded videos, and we're going to be creating content continuously for that. So teachers will be able to go on. That's all asynchronous, so it's all just recorded. But we're also doing synchronous versions of all of those programs, so teachers could log on with a naturalist live and they can engage that classroom in real time. So we're really excited about that. We're also working on K through five programming. Going to be rolling that out next semester. So we really focused on the Clifer side portion, which was that middle school component, but we also have some K through five programming and preschool programming. Obviously, PNC, we had the grant for Grow Up Great and the Eco Explorers. Well, they're not allowing visitors into the classroom. So we're also working on some programming for those younger children. Our youth outdoors program took a big hit, obviously, with the rec centers being closed and not being able to gauge the community in their normal ways. But there are what CMSD put together, they're called pods, where the kids can go to a centralized location and do their virtual programming, you know, in a non-traditional space, a gym at a rec center or something like that. So there's about 240 students that do that and are supervised by somebody that's not from CMSD, where they literally sit down at computers, do their virtual programming in a different space. Well, we've been able to go out to those spaces and engage those kids as they're waiting for their parents to pick them up or they're waiting for their rides home. So there's this time in between the end of their virtual programming and before they go home where they're in that pod area with their students. So we've been actually going out and engaging and doing programming with those kids after they're done with their virtual program. So that was a really great opportunity, and the staff have tried extremely hard to be creative to still engage, especially kids during this time, and work with teachers and school districts.
Joe, how is that done? I mean, do they bring animals and that sort of thing, or?
Yeah. I mean, obviously with the COVID protocols and, you know, touching and sharing of equipment and things like that, we're somewhat limited, but just getting the kids outdoors, exposing them to different types of experiences. Yeah, we literally go in, we can bring an animal, we can bring different types of equipment when the weather was a little bit nicer. If the facility was close to a trail, we can go outside, we can talk about hiking, we can go over maps of Cleveland Metro Parks and say, here's what you can do with your family. So we've been doing anything and everything in between there. So we really work with those, the folks who run the pods and the CMSD teachers themselves on what do the kids in that pod, what can they do, how long are they going to be there. So every situation is extremely unique and different, which has made it that much more challenging. So a lot of the first semester was planning and calls and teacher meetings and Zooms with, you know, directors of curriculum and instruction. You know, the West Creek team has reached out to Parma Heights. I think I wrote it down here. Three different schools. Oh, here is Cleveland Heights, Parma School District, and University Heights. And they've been working with the sewer district. The West Creek Center was engaging with middle school children to get service credits back for the watershed program in all of those school districts. Well, they've been able to create what was a 3-hour in-person program, made it 1-hour virtual synchronous program, and still been able to deliver that content to all of those classes and all of those kids so that that school district can still get their credit. So the first semester was really planning. A lot of these programs are just being launched now in second semester, especially the synchronous programming where they're live in the class. But we've got more requests than we can even handle right now. And the team's really proud of that work. It's not the same. And, you know, the public isn't necessarily seeing us out in the community as much, but we're heavily engaged. So we're very proud of that. So that's all I have, unless you have any questions.
No, it's great to hear.
Sorry, I threw a lot at you really fast, but I wanted to get it in.
Thank you.
Chris, I think, is up next.
I think also on this slide, you know, created the IDEA task force for this Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Accessibility Committee. That's something that, you know, the work continues and it's ongoing and it's evolving. Rosa's led it for a number of years. Natalie Ronan has taken over. We've got a few people that are really digging deep in how we look at the overall organization, and that's definitely come out of this most recently. Chris, welcome.
Good morning, commissioners. So obviously my team participated in the virtual classrooms. My education team worked with marketing and participated in that as well. But one of the things that was really important early on for us is we recognized very early on in the closure that, you know, all businesses have some level of relatively fixed costs with staff, but we can't furlough the animals, right? We knew that that was going to be an additional fixed cost. I can't spend 50% less on food or reduce the temperature by 50% just because we needed to be in that situation. And we knew that because of the pandemic, and I had spent the year as the AZA board chair, I knew no one else was taking on additional costs, right? There wasn't a way to move these animals out and send them someplace else. So we had to have conversations very early on how do we maintain relevancy to the community so that when we have the opportunity to reopen, what will we do that will encourage them to come back? How can we be relevant to them? And again, one of the advantages of AZA is you get to have these conversations with other people who are trying crazy things. And Brian and I had a lot of conversations early on what if we drove vehicles through the zoo? What if we were able to bring vehicles through the zoo? And Brian and I got a lot of sideways looks when we first started talking about this. It didn't really make any sense. And I'll say, while I have often mentally cursed the layout of our zoo, it was an absolute blessing in this case because what it did is allowed us to drive vehicles through the zoo. And we created the Cruise the Zoo event even before we were able to open up to foot traffic. We were able to open without actually being open because folks never actually left their car. We kept them in their car and we were able to bring in 9,000 vehicles at the end of May and the beginning of June. We average about 4 person per vehicle because we charge based off of the vehicle price. So that's roughly 32,000 individuals who are able to experience the zoo and the Cruise the Zoo concept. And not only did it bring revenue into the system, but we started hearing a lot of feedback from folks I brought my grandparents, I brought my parents, people who haven't been to the zoo in 30, 40, 50 years, they were able to come out to the zoo and they absolutely loved it. Mm-hmm. And that made us really think, well, gosh, if that worked, maybe part of that was the pandemic, right? Maybe part of that was just the idea to get out in a safe way, but maybe it was also just an accessibility piece. Maybe it was another opportunity to bring folks in here. So when we brought in Asian Lantern Festival in July, we added specific drive-through days. So overall, Asian Lantern Festival had 165,000 guests go through it. We extended it many more days than we had in previous year to be able to reach that audience because our walking attendance was at a 25% capacity. But again, we were able to bring in over 4,000 vehicles in the Asian Lantern Festival event, an additional 16,000 people. And again, the feedback we got was, again, my parents, my grandparents, I have mobility issues, I can't get around. This was a really great opportunity for us. So we did that for Asian Lantern Festival. We did it also with Wild Winter Lights. We brought in over 106,000 people for Wild Winter Lights. And again, on that one, we don't have the finalized numbers yet, but we're talking probably another 12,000 guests who drove through the experience as opposed to walking through it. So it's really made us think long term. And just yesterday, Brian and I were on a call and we heard from donors that who often are older, have more mobility issues, at this point really don't necessarily want to come out of their house necessarily. This is an opportunity that we'll probably continue to explore into 2021 and maybe even in a post-pandemic world where we look at this as an opportunity to be relevant to a community that struggles to get through our 183 acres. So that was a big learning for us.
Chris, how would you, I like what you're thinking here, how would you prioritize the days that could be grandparents' days or whatever you'd want to call it? An 80-year-old, most 80-year-olds aren't going to walk, aren't going to take their grandchildren through the zoo. It's just too long.
Yeah.
I mean, would you do it? You'd pick the least popular day probably, right?
Well, I think what we would probably look at is do a portion of a day. So either a couple hours in the beginning. So we're doing it 8 to 10 a.m. or we're going to do it 3 to 5 p.m. or 5 to 7 p.m. or something like that. So as, because it's a confusing message to the public. And we've had a number of folks who come from a long distance who just assume that we're going to be open on Tuesday. And to have that be a drive-through only day, there's the potential for disappointment there. We have to balance memberships who, we sell those memberships and the sort of the contract with them is we're providing access. So we have to figure out what that looks like. I'm not sure yet, Commissioner, to make a long story short, but could I think that there is a way that we can balance that and really get benefit from it.
Could you have cars and people intermingle?
I don't think so. I wouldn't trust it. I'm always concerned about just our tram service driving through the zoo because it's the same path that we're walking on.
Yeah.
We could potentially make some long-term changes and have a separate guest path, but on a busy day, I don't want vehicles driving through the zoo. I don't let my staff, unless it's emergency, we don't drive vehicles in the zoo during the day because of that potential safety issue. So we'd have to figure out where the, and you're 100% right. There's a way to prioritize that, to get that demographic that doesn't want to come and walk 183 acres. I think that's what we learned. I don't think we considered that to be, have enough potential, have enough relevancy, but I think what we've learned is that it does.
I like your idea of early in the morning, so because most people come after 9, I would assume, don't they, or 10?
Well, we are an early zoo. Whatever time we open, I have a line. I mean, in the summer. Now, this time of year, no. But we're an early attendance zoo. But I think that we can provide that opportunity. One of the reasons why we open at the time we do is to get the animal care staff to be able to get in, get the exhibit set, and we don't have too long of a day. Our outdoor exhibits, which is what this is relevant to, right? This doesn't, PCA doesn't get any benefit from a drive-through event. The rainforest doesn't get any benefit from a drive-through event. Those buildings take a lot longer to set up in the morning than does the bears, the tigers. That's a much easier setup. So we could bring folks into the zoo earlier to be able to and have that experience.
Very good. Thanks.
And then the last thing I'll just mention is we also looked at another two events. One was Trick or Treat Fest, which was a first time event for us this year. Historically, we've done Boo at the Zoo, which is a very cost intensive event. And without being able to put 8,000, 9,000 people in the zoo, it doesn't make sense for us financially. So we pivoted to Trick or Treat Fest and found an overwhelming appreciation for the event, not just for the opportunity for kids to go out and do things, because we didn't know, many communities didn't know if they were going to have Trick or Treat for their kids this year. But we provided a safe event, but we recognized that people really value that Trick or Treat experience, and they were fine with doing it during the daytime. So that provides us an opportunity, again, to be relevant to the community moving forward. And then the last thing is the Cleveland Zoo Society does some fundraising events throughout the year. They do Zippity Zoo Do, or they do Twilight at the Zoo, both large volume events that weren't going to happen this year. They pivoted to smaller, basically smaller donor-led dinners, 10-person events, because that's what we were able to do in terms of a capacity. And what those events did was not only bring in money to help the Zoo Society survive this year, but they allowed us to have really good conversations. Myself, Sarah Krupe would come in and have a conversation with a donor. Brian attended one of those events. And what one of those events translated to was a full zoo rental in early January of this year, because we were able to make a one-on-one connection through that small event that you get lost in a 500-person event. You're able to have conversations and talk about the relevancy of the zoo and talk about the importance of the zoo and provide an experience that we really weren't able to previously. So being able to pivot provided a lot of different relevancy opportunities that we didn't necessarily even knew we had or that we needed. So we learned, we pivoted, and we're going to continue to do that in 2021 and beyond.
Yes.
Are those Great. Dinners in the zoo actually or not? Or just
yes, in the zoo. That's mm-hmm. really cool. So and they had all the COVID protocols associated with them, mm-hmm. seated while you're eating. You couldn't walk around with a drink, which is all weird, but we were able to make it work, and they were very successful.
That's really cool.
Chris, it shouldn't be thought of as small groups versus big groups, because I think small groups will have, you'll hit more individual people and get money out of that. I think the large group things just increases awareness about the zoo. And I've forgotten all the names, but Zippity Zoo and a few of these where you get young professionals.
Yep.
Is very important.
You want to talk about the herd real quick?
What's that?
The herd?
Well, yeah. So the herd is the Zoo Society's young professional group. And we just kind of used to just call it the young professionals group, but they wanted a name. They have their own sort of logo brand associated with it. And that was a group that really struggled with the opportunity to get in person, which is really what they thrive off of, right? Those young professionals really thrive off of that networking opportunity, the opportunity to meet, have a drink, have a conversation. We're going to continue that in 2021. That was kind of hampered in 2020 because of all the restrictions that we were dealing with. But I think you're exactly right, Commissioner. We're still going to have those larger events because they do provide a window in a different format that really works. I think what we learned is we added another arrow to our quiver. We know now that this is an opportunity that we should do alongside of those other events. We're going to continue to have folks come into the zoo and walk through Asian Lantern Festival, but we should probably consider having a drive-through opportunity at some point. So I think what we're doing is adding opportunities to make ourselves more accessible and provide a wider audience for ourselves.
Do you like the herd name or the pack name? Which would you?
For the game.
There's always going to be new opportunities, so we'll have to keep that one in mind.
You're a jet.
Continuing to evolve, right?
Very
right.
Good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sean is going to step up next and talk about connections.
Thank you. Good to see you again. So I want to walk through some of the very quickly success that we had this year in working through COVID. We did not stop. Although in that March timeframe, when the orders continued to come out from the governor and we were looking at what activities may be restricted, we were always looking for specifically whether construction activities would have any impact. We were very lucky in that we were able to continue working, and our contractors all did so very aggressively and very safely. And so now, in January, looking back at last year, we're able to see the tremendous amount of progress we got done at Bonnie Park. The fact that we were able to have an opening on Towpath Stage 3 took a few months for us to figure out how to do it best and safely, but we did it virtually with our partners. At the Daniel Maltarino Reserve, in working with Lawler Construction, you know, that was our one project where we had people working closely together. And to get contractors into the mentality that they already have a hard hat on, they already have, you know, eye protection on, they get all their PPE, now you need to add a mask if you're working within close contact of anyone, it was interesting. It was a daily effort. We had daily briefings. We had meetings out in the field where we'd spread out and talk about how to best do this, and everyone complied. It worked out great. Really had a great attitude to get these projects done. Great progress at Brighton Park. Buddy Construction has done a wonderful job there. Edgewater Play Space, Jim Rodstrom and the trades and site crews have done incredible work there, all while doing it safely through very challenging both weather and conditions. Huntington, we were able to take what likely were the worst restrooms in the entire park district to now potentially some of the best. And the timing is perfect because each restroom is basically its own in terms of it is a small room where you can be in there with you or just your family, and we are not commingling people into a tight space. And then the Tiger Trails. We were able to make great progress, if not stay on or ahead of schedule on most. All the crews did wonderful. Mark Haynes Construction, Great Lakes Construction, very, very serious commitments to safety. I do want to end, though, that those are construction. We had to continue to plan and continue to plan with public input. And one of the ways, and I got to give a lot of credit to the planning and design team and Kelly Kaufman specifically, is our CHEERS project, Cleveland Harbor East Eastern Embayment Resiliency Study. Typically, we'd like to have a public meeting. And in the public meeting, we have it in a room. And if we get 25, 50 people, that's a huge success. Well, we were able to just flip that on its head and have outdoor walk shops. In working with risk management, we were able to set up the fact that we could have small, you know, less than 10 groups. We set out three time slots over 2 days. We had more than 100 attendees in these small groups. And not only did we have attendees, we had attendees from the neighborhood. We had attendees from in and around Cleveland and the region. And Commissioner Berry, thank you for attending. And we got some of the best public feedback we've ever gotten before on a project like this, where people walked around, took notes, we had discussions, we had a scavenger hunt, and we were able to do that in a safe environment where we got good feedback that then helps us take the next step and develop a plan, all while doing it in this midst of COVID. So it was a challenging year, very good year. The team and all of our partners worked really hard to continue our effort towards connections.
I just want to comment on those workshops. I hope we continue to keep those as part of our, it was one of the best learning experiences just to see how other people use the park and have that interaction. There were, I think, six of us and Kelly, and it was fantastic. I mean, it's, you're really out there feeling something and talking to other people. And I met people I'd never met before, and it was terrific.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sean.
Hi, Kelly. Happy belated birthday.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. So on the final strategic priority here, time to explore, just wanted to keep it in front and center that we have maintained, you know, most of our parks have maintained being open. The golf courses, there's been certain areas that have closed during periods of times, and throughout it, we have continued to keep the community engaged. We did scale back our paid advertising efforts. We were still able to do some through corporate partnership that was fully funded. But where we really ramped up was social media and also earned media. So more than ever, our communication team was working with the news media, whether we were fielding requests or pitching stories. And what we saw is tremendous coverage. We have noted here over 2,000 stories, and that was an increase year over year significantly by both parks and zoo. And I think back to you know, some of the weeks and days where we had Brian doing interviews with the media, you know, in a time where it was questioning, will the parks stay open, and other, you know, other states across the country were closing parks and closing beaches, and we didn't shy away from it. Brian did not shy away from it. We spoke to the media. We answered questions. We asked the public to do their part. Right there, we've got our buzzard and do your part, stay 6 feet apart. We had those throughout the park district. That became its own campaign. There were different executions where for tobogganing, we used the toboggan to represent 6 feet. So really just having some fun with it. It stood out. Flattery, we actually had other park districts taking that exact sign and putting their park district logo on it. So I guess, you know, that's a compliment. But through those stories and all that effort and hard work, if we were to measure that as ad equivalency through our media monitoring tool, just wanted to note that's over $20 million of value and billions, literally billions of impressions. So we were fortunate to get out there, share the message. When we had special events and things that we were able to do in a safe way, the media wanted to promote that and, you know, wanted to be here and wanted to talk about it. So we are fortunate to have a lot of that coverage. We were able to get out and do some visual observations of some of our high trafficked, easy accessible trails throughout the park district and compare that to some prior years when we used to do that. And in May, we saw a spike of 81% of people. And we're still trying to learn exactly who those folks were. We know we got a lot of new first-time users. A lot of our repeat users were continuing to come as well and checking out new areas and locations. It was mentioned earlier, you know, people working from home, people having more free time and needing places and outlets and things to go. And we remained that community asset. Golf, again, just touching on the increase there. I also wanted to, oh, yes.
Kelly, mm-hmm. How did you measure trail use? Mm-hmm. Did you individually count or did you use cameras?
So for this particular exercise, we had folks stationed, volunteers, throughout all the reservations and some, again, easily accessible all-purpose trails, some of the more popular ones. And they literally mirrored our previous studies where it was specific days of the week, times, and we're able to look at that year over year and just do an average across all the reservations. Some had higher than 81%, but that was the average. And we continue to look at the full year. I actually bumped into Beth Caduti this morning. She's getting all the meters collected, and we're going to do that full year analysis here in the near term. So definitely some heavy usage there. I also wanted to touch on the Hinckley Boathouse. So from a retail standpoint, all of our retail shops were closed as the nature centers closed. The boathouse, we were able to put that forward, again, talking about reallocation of staff. A lot of the outdoor experiences team where the nature centers were closed came over, trained, helped us put forth to the community a really safe experience to be able to rent boats and get out on the water. We migrated over to a completely online reservation and waiver system to be able to do that in an even more safe way. The team just looked at the revenue this morning, and they've been able to bring in $275,000 of revenue. So again, that could have been a place that was closed, but we were able to open it, make it safe, and take a lot of learnings that we'll use in the future. Riverfest was mentioned, the Winter Riverfest. We popped up a holiday shop there as well, and we're able to bring in $20,000 of revenue. And again, looking back at things that we've learned in the past, we used to have a kiosk that had a high, you know, rental cost in the malls during the holiday. And what a more profitable way to do the holiday shop, as well as really pumping up our online retail and selling masks and things. So a great story there. Those were some of the time to explore highlights, unless there's any questions.
Very impressive.
That's awesome. Yeah, good stuff.
I think just to bring it home, and Harold said it best, don't let a good crisis pass you by to rethink. When we think of the igloos, we think of the drive-thru, we think of how we did our business. And while we kept doing business across the entire park district, I am immensely proud of this organization.
Great testimony.
Yeah.
That's true.
Very good.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Very good. The next information and last one we have is the Trails Division 2020. Again, this is just a further, you know, highlight of our connections and relevancies. We know that from our studies that, you know, over 76 and probably higher now, but people use our trails across the park district. We know that it has been a focus of this park district to improve them. Jim Rodstrom is here, and Ralph is out of the woods this morning. Ralph is all dressed up without his Carhartts on. I barely recognized him.
Thank you.
Thank you.
But this has been a true success of the park district across, when I think of all the different trails that have been impacted and the quality of trails and how it's helping expand our guest-focused trail experience. I will turn it over to Jim and Ralph.
Great, thank you. Good morning, everybody. It's great to be back. It's been a little while, so it's nice to see everyone. So Ralph's going to talk about the year in review for the Trails Division. And before he does that, I want to take just a couple seconds to not only talk about when he gets into his report, but just where we're at as a Trails Division as a whole. So Ralph came to us about 9 years ago, just shy of 9 years, and this will be his 10th construction season managing the Trails Division. And, you know, we've watched him build the division up from scratch. You know, we started a new division and hired Ralph in as the first employee to a new division, a new specialty skilled trades division. Built it up, we tore it down. We built it up, we tore it down. We went through that process probably every year for the first 4 or 5 years. Staff changed over. We didn't have anybody on staff besides Ralph who had any type of natural surface trail construction abilities. Ralph has taken it upon himself to not only further that staff into being one of our elite skilled trades divisions, but also himself, in my opinion, being one of the most well-accomplished professional trail builders, in my opinion, at least in the Midwest. So I'm going to turn it over to him, but when we started, we gave Ralph a rusty Dodge pickup truck and some shovels and told him to get to work. And where we're at today and the technology and the professionalism that he's brought to the Trails Division is very, very impressive. So without further ado, I'll let him take over.
And before Ralph takes over, a funny story is, what Jim is saying is 100% true. We literally said, you are going to be at Royal View. Please do not come out of the woods until this trail is built. And one day I'm driving down the road and there Ralph was with a map. He popped literally right. Do you remember that day? He popped literally right out of the trail. I'm like, Ralph, how are you? I haven't seen you in a couple months. He goes, you told me to build this trail and not to come out of the woods until it was done. So we're very proud of his entire team. So
maybe a tent out there still. yeah, thank you so much. I don't think it's possible to love your job more than I do. So I appreciate all of you guys for.
We love that you love your job too. That's so great.
Thank you. So 2020, I mean, as we navigate through these unprecedented times, I think we can all see that the need for high quality, sustainable trails has been magnified, which is why I believe it's the perfect time to showcase where we've come as a division and the direction that I'm pushing us into. I believe the Trails Division can be a cornerstone for Cleveland Metro Parks. Juxtaposing the rich history of the WPA and CCC with modern innovation in a way that pays equal respect for our community and the amazing natural resources that make up the Cleveland Metro Parks. So let's see if I can do this. I'm more of a, there we go, am I going to this? Okay, I can work this pen. Okay, so the Brecksville Gorge project, as you see here, this is the main showcase from 2020. It's a new trail construction. It's designed to address a hillside that was torn up from years of people who were hopping over a fence to reach down the Chippewa Creek. It's truly a legacy project. I believe the Cleveland Metro Parks will be celebrating this trail in its next centennial. And it was built with that exactly in mind. The trail itself becomes part of the experience. So this is what it would look like. These are our rock staircases. That's one of the major features of this trail project. It's entirely dry laid, so there's no mortar, set by hand like a puzzle. It's very difficult and time consuming work, but with an expected life expectancy of over 100 years, it will definitely pay for itself in the long run. Next, you can see the actual trail construction, and you'll see there's a combination of a machine cut and hand cut trail, depending on the location. And we're always striving to create the bare minimum impact on the landscape while dancing around the terrain in a way that is playful and gets in the way that it brings users to their destination. I expected that this trail is going to get a lot of traffic, so we've improved the surface. You can see on the lower right corner a screen plant that I borrowed from the zoo. As we've begun making our own trail surface material with a blended surface that has a natural mix of sand, silt, and gravel. So getting away from that clay that we're probably all very familiar with right now in these really difficult freeze-thaw periods.
So it does it sort of self-compact and yet hold its...
Yes. So image. If you think about it, you know, like we have a lot of silt and that's like glue. Sand gives itself some percolation and a little bit of gravel gives it the firmness that it needs. So the structure. So it's like a pure loam. So we're kind of taking everything that we have and reblending it in a way that it's ideal.
Ralph, can I ask a question about the width of the trail?
Yep.
Some of these are very wide and substantial. Mm-hmm. Does it make any sense to have them more narrow and maybe expandable, you know, so they're not running right next to trees, so they could be made bigger? But how do we, like the difference between what the upper left, yep, and the lower right?
That's 5.5 feet wide.
I was going to say, that's, yeah, like the loop.
So if you look at our standard bridle trail right now, you're looking at about 10 feet wide. I'm trying to cut our max width in half.
But take the one at the top, yep, the top left. I know that's under construction, so it's not done, but that's a lot narrower than the lower right, right?
Yes, exactly. Yep.
And so how wide would you say the one on the upper left is?
I'd say that's probably about 3 feet at that
three
point
feet,
of construction.
Yeah, which,
yeah,
I think is perfect.
Yep.
And then you don't see it as much. You don't have to, if you're benching it into a hill, you don't have to take as much of the hill.
Yep.
And I think most of the time, I mean, do people think they have to be able to cross on a mountain bike without turning off the trail a little bit? What
goes into determining width?
You know, I think 5.5 is my max width, because that's something where people can walk side by side and allow for passing. We want to keep the trails as narrow as possible because we want the water to move and get off of the trail.
I mean, I know, like the Sylvan Loop Trail, it's typically narrow almost throughout.
Yep, and a lot of times what you see is like, you could start with a wider base and then it will narrow itself over time. Mm. What we don't want is like the old school, take a bulldozer, 8 foot wide and make it into a road.
Right.
So, I mean, if you can, so like this is kind of like at a brand new level of construction, but what we found is if we've undersized the trail, if you don't have that shoulder area, you know, as the trail migrates a little bit, you can kind of lose your original design specs if you keep it just a little bit too narrow. But again, that's always going to depend on the use. You know, we're talking about a lot of people. This is right behind the Nature Center. It's a short trail.
Yeah, I understand.
So we're like, you know, where we've done some stuff at West Creek, it's shared use mountain biking. That's at 24 to 30 inches max, the entire trail system, and it works perfectly that way. It's a longer trail, so not everybody's going to be doing 2 or 3 miles there. So this is what I would call like a group trail. You know, it's more of like a destination. Let's bring the whole school group down. Let's bring the whole family. You know, the little ones can kind of meander from here to there safely. And being able to juxtapose that with like these kind of more narrow trails that you're talking about that, you know, are basically hidden in the landscape, I think that gives us the portfolio that we need to meet like this very dynamic community, you know, compared to like where I was in the Appalachian Trail where everybody's like rucksack and go, you know, yet people's idea of what a trail should be is very different.
So you're really tailoring trails. You're customizing for a variety of variables.
Exactly. I think that we need to have, like, they can't all be the same, you know? And I think that's what we kind of had. But we kind of had two options before. It was like a wide road or like an old bootleg that we've converted into a trail. And I think that the sustainability can kind of find something that's in there. And I feel like the blueprint just needs to be a little bit dynamic.
Thank you.
For sure. So looking at some of the structures here, this is the overlook bridge at the gorge. This is a major highlight on the way down to the main stone staircase. You can see it cantilevers out off of a beautiful ledge and it provides a sneak peek down to the creek below. The supports are tied right into the rock ledge and it's made entirely from lumber that we made ourselves. Leading into that bridge is what I've called the log ladder. Kind of a bit of a floating staircase. And here, Dan, and this is actually a cool thing about the trail, is this kind of tucks into about 24, 30 inch treads. So it doesn't always have to be, you know, the trail width can kind of expand and contract as to kind of reflect the site.
Yeah.
So you're kind of sneaking through this little bit of a crevice through here. Again, this is made of black walnut that we made ourselves. It was built by hand. And the crew even fabricated all of the brackets and stuff to tie it in. And it's just a really cool experience because you're kind of like sneaking through this tunnel and then you would land at that overlook bridge and kind of get that relief to see out below. So having that sort of, you know, creating those kinds of experiences that people don't realize kind of turns the trail into something new.
How slippery does that wood surface get on those treads?
So they're probably about 30 inches wide, and they're not a super narrow trail. What's interesting is, like, you're so tight in the rock, and we were kind of deciding handrails, you can almost use the ledge on the way down. So I've been on it a lot of, you know, there's been a lot of wet conditions, and I've felt really safe on them.
Cool.
So let's see.
So you're telling us you put a lot of thought into it.
Definitely, for sure.
Ralph, can I ask one other question?
Of course.
The Disabilities Acts, as it relates to railing, to what extent do paths like this have to comply with that?
So Trails falls under its own accessibility guidelines called the Architectural Barriers Act. And okay. What, you know, it kind of allows for a little bit more flexibility in terms of when railings or when, like, you know, certain, you know, having steps or certain things like that. I mean, in this case, we had to get down in a very small confined area, so it was impossible to get down the hillside with any other feature besides the staircase.
Yeah.
But rather than make it, you know, like a rope that people are like trying to belay down, we've turned it into something that's a little bit more than, a little bit more like kind of accepting of people. And then just like in terms of the railings and stuff like that, you know, it depends on the site. You know, we want to keep this really natural. We've like kind of gone back and forth on the railings. I've been hiking this staircase for a year and a half, deciding whether or not I want to put railings on it. I feel really comfortable on it. My 2-year-old son has been coming with me on it, and I feel pretty comfortable with him scurrying up and down it. So, you know, we kind of need to make those decisions based on the site. And that's how people have kind of done things for years. I know I like walk it around Fort Hill, and there are places where there's a guardrail, and there are other places where there aren't. And you know, there's really no guidelines for where or where they shouldn't be.
Is there signage at all for some of these?
Or in terms of?
Well, I'd like to let somebody know they've hit a point that might be more of a challenge than that.
What I like to do is describe at the trail, you know, have something interpretive at the trailhead so that people understand what they're looking for below.
Okay.
And then I think what happens is, like, here, you know, there's almost like levels. Like, you can kind of get down the first staircase and we'll have a bench there. So, and like Sylvan Loop's another example of just like that, where like not everybody's going to take that steep hike down to where that main overlook.
Right.
And we have a second trail up there. So it's almost like, okay, there's level one, level two, and level three, stacking the difficulty layers so people can kind of decide and see for themselves, you know? And a lot of times what we'll do is this trail kind of starts out with these staircases, and we call that kind of a qualifier. Like, you want your most technical trail feature to be shown right at the trailhead, so someone doesn't go all the way down and then is surprised.
Mm-hmm.
So by introducing those steps right at the beginning of the trail, people kind of know what to expect as they make their way down.
Thank you.
For sure. So this is going to open in spring of 2021, and I highly encourage you guys to come out and take a look for it yourself then. The next project I wanted to showcase is this boardwalk that we built on the Buckeye Trail near Snowville Road. It was a joint project that I was able to do with the Buckeye Trail Association. We worked together to identify this really important section of trail. It connects right to the national park. So if you're coming from the national park into Metro Parks, this was like almost your gateway. And if you could see on this top left, this is what was here before. This is unpassable for most of the year. You know, so it's like beyond muddy. Like, you pretty much had to swim to get to this bridge. And if you're coming from Ottawa Point down, you would land at that bridge here. And then, like, you know, I remember, you know, training for the Burning River and getting to this point, and it's like, yeah, after 3 miles, you know, this turns into a Spartan race, I guess. So you know, we worked together. We came in the winter months because it's such a wet area. We were able to transport all of the lumber in with that Canicom, constructed this new at grade from the bank down into the meadow below, and now it's something that people can utilize.
How long is that stretch?
Throughout the year, I'd say it's about 300 or so feet total structure, and it kind of transitions. It's very hot. These are up on piers that we built, and they come from the bank, so there's like a couple steps, this bridge section, and then here we have the railing because we're up a little bit higher. and then it transitions into the boardwalk. Everything's coming down at 5%. And this is what we call a punch-in at the bottom with these mud sills, and they kind of bring you out into the meadow. So this project actually earned us a partnership award with the Buckeye Trail for 2020. And we're looking to continue to improve this section and other sections of the Buckeye Trail as we move forward. The next thing I wanted to talk about is our mountain bike trail management. So we have four mountain bike trail systems at this point. And again, the goal for these trails are to have that very natural and narrow trails and build them in a way. But we also want to build them in a way that they can be open for use as many days of the year as possible. That's what we've found is really the overarching goal is not necessarily the sheer number of miles, but the quality of miles. People want to be able to get out for half hour, an hour, as many days of the year and ride and have a good experience. And on our end, we want it to be, you know, protecting the surrounding landscape. So this is one of the first projects we did in the early COVID months, you know, when we were trying to keep everybody in maximum isolation. And we did this flagstone armoring at West Creek. And a lot of the work that we had trained the crews on at the Brecksville Gorge really played nicely into this. But again, here we're using flagstone. It's a little bit lighter than those huge outcroppings that you saw at the gorge. And the stone, again, is set like a puzzle piece. We were able to just take some of these really lower draining areas or slow draining areas and fortify them. So West Creek, which is now like our most sustainable trail, you compare that to Royal View, and we have our open closure policies that you guys might be familiar with. This trail is open over 40 days more per year than Royal View. So being able to just kind of work toward those metrics. So since the scope of work was beyond what we could accomplish in one season, we also installed what we call these mud mats. So these are like these temporary structures, just plywood pinned to the ground with chicken wire on them for traction. And during these like kind of wet hinge months, we lay them down. And then when the summer, when things are dried out, the water table's dropped, we take them out and then it's back to a natural trail. So
mountain bike duck boards.
Yeah, just like a real simple Band-Aid. So we have these out at West Creek right now. We're able to get this trail open still. We've done a little bit at Bedford too. So I've mentioned Royal View, which has a lot of muddy sections, a lot of drainage issues. You can see here on the top left, and this is what was originally, you know, an 18-inch trail had increased to 16 to 18 feet wide in places, which is a lot of impact. And it's actually, if you ride a bike, it's not very fun to try and get through there. Because, you know, if you've ridden a mountain bike, it's a lot about having this flow and just kind of letting nature direct you through the trail. And when it gets really blown out like that, you kind of lose your momentum, lose the trail. So we were able to narrow it back up. We built a new foundation, introducing our material that I mentioned before, getting it back into that 18 to 24 inch width. And you can see it's like a little bit wider, but you just see how this is in the fall, how everything just kind of narrows back up to that little ribbon, which is exactly what we're going for. We've done over a half mile up to this point. We're continuing to prioritize some major sections because, you know, Royal View is such a popular place. It is a great trail. We want to protect it, and we want to, you know, hit that mission of getting it open as many days of the year as possible.
Ralph, do we have any way of measuring how many people, how well the bike paths are being used?
We have done counters and things in the past. I could tell you that uses, as somebody that's, I know I'm out there all the time on all these trails, and the uses for bikes are just like way up. There's a lot of people who have come in, started riding this year. But I know that they do have like TrackX counters and things that they've done in the past. At West Creek, we did some just like wildlife counters just to kind of get the feel of what we had in terms of bike versus hike use there as well. So we have done things like that, and we could definitely look into doing it again.
I mean, I obviously we know that the foundation of this whole organization is trails, and here it's up 81% this year. I mean, so it's a phenomenal how important this is to the Metro Park, and I think it would be nice to measure some of this stuff. I know we're measuring trails, and we're of course way up, but it'd be interesting to find out if the biking stuff is really being used, and if the horse stuff is really being used, and you know what's being used. You know what is being consumed versus what we're offering.
Definitely, and I think a lot. You know, just from my eye, just the, it's a lot so location based, you know what I mean, in terms of how people are using trails in different parks, west side versus east side, you know, et cetera, the nature center and things like that.
Thank you.
So yeah, so in addition, you know, we've taken on a lot of just the standard TLC maintenance of these mountain bike trails, working alongside our volunteers, making sure that there's just a standard model and that there's accountability. I'm not just like, you're the volunteer group, go and do it. We want to make sure that our, especially like you said, we know use was way up. So we wanted to make sure that our corridors were open, comfortable to go through. We've worked on retopping some of our existing projects with that new surface material, leaf blowing to help keep that trail narrow and identified through the fall, just protecting our existing benching by just like coming through a quick pass with rakes. Something else that we've had a lot of success with the chicken wire on bikes, and for safety, wrapping a lot of our bridges, existing bridges, with that chicken wire to create traction. That was like to the point that Bruce made about like the decking and things like that. This one's really near and dear to my heart, the trail signage updates. I remember back my first few years here, I got lost in every major reservation in the metro parks.
That can be fun.
There's a lot of fun. I know every corner of this place. You know, now that I know it so well, I just take it for granted. And I realize like a lot of people that are here, we've been hiking the same trails our whole life, right? So we take these parks for granted. But now we're talking about COVID, we're talking about use getting up, and part of my mission is to make sure that you come to a park for the first time and you have a great experience, that you're not trying to figure out where you are. So we've made these new signs. They kind of build off of the style of what's existing in terms of like the marker symbols, but we've added more information that are useful to people, like distances, how to get to destinations, user types, etc. And then also keeping them natural. This is all made from black locust posts, that a lot of it's just salvaged from around the park. We use a lot of our cutoffs from our mill and decking for these backers. So it's all produced in-house, and then Viscom is making the vinyl metal signs and stuff. So this is North Chagrin, which we worked on in the last year. And you know, a lot of times people, like in the past, I think have put the signs up and said we're done and have forgotten about it. And you can see what happens over time, like with these markers and things like that. So I want to make sure that the system is really well cared for. So we inventoried every single thing that we put up, every little marker in the woods.
And another thing you did was knocking down a bunch of trees and blocking entire bootleg trails, I noticed.
We did, yeah. And that's kind
of
a build off
of
this.
Took away some of our bootlegs. Yeah.
So actually, I'll get into that a little bit more in a few slides. So we put these new markers up, and then part of it was I wanted to take every single old sign out. It was just such a pet peeve for me to see something like this. So I was climbing up here in, you know, with a harness and ladders to get up in these high trees with an angle grinder, whatever it took to just pull these signs out, get the new stuff in, and make our just like that baseline, make the park showcase as good as it really is. So this is the whole process that we kind of went through to get the signs in, and now it's all handed over to our volunteers, and they are monitoring the, you know, they're monitoring, they have an inventory of where these locations are. They hike it once a month. We made an app for them so that they can say if something's been damaged, if things are replaced or vandalized, we can go back out and do them immediately. We keep the rangers in the loop, because what we're finding is like that's kind of patterns, like people are sort of stealing the same markers from the same place over and over again. So that's kind of giving us a baseline to let them know that, you know, we put a lot into this, we care about our trails, and you know, we're going to protect every part of it. So you can see this is the old marker before. It was just, you know, this is just like a hiker symbol arrow left and right. If you're colorblind, you'd be kind of in a pickle. And this is what we've moved to. So just, this is really important to me, just like the wayfinding component. And that's what people really want to know. How do I get to this picnic area or Squire's Castle, etc. So this is Bruce's point. While I was doing that, the signage work, you kind of realized that there was a greater need for trail management. Here we're using North Chagrin as a baseline, but I think at every major reservation, like in the metro parks. So part of it was just like, again, just keeping these trails clear. You know, this is Castle Valley, like in the middle of the summer, and you know, it's not very fun with the walk through this and be covered in ticks or something at the end. So we went through, got a lot of, this is right when we were allowed to start bringing volunteers back post-COVID, small groups, you know, you could see some of them out here with their rakes and stuff, and we're just running brush cutters, opening up these trails, making sure that, you know, they wouldn't get closed in. And then here was to Bruce's point, the need for just restoration. I was realizing that some of these bootlegs are wider than our regular trails, you know? So, and I think that was part of the navigation issue, not necessarily people intentionally trying to go off trail, but it was just hard to distinguish the two. And then I think for us to just show how much we really care about, you know, protecting these areas, like helping to expedite the restoration process. So we went in, it was a combined project with volunteers and our staff to break the ground up and to cover some of these areas back up with brush. NR has come back in with some plantings. We've even done some straw and winter ride just to help get that reestablished. And then the leaf fall comes in and helps just mass those areas up. And we've just had incredible success. And I remember when I came here, people told me that you couldn't get rid of the bootlegs. And I just didn't believe that. And I'm really happy to just show that, like, you know, we can do this. And I think it's really important because we're talking about this balance. We have new trail ideas. We want to improve the system, but we need to create that balance and the ability to show that we can give something back. We can restore the landscape. And also, like, that side piece of now people are less confused when they're trying to navigate our system because they see this wide trail. What is this here for? And they end up on, you know, somewhere they didn't want to be. So the last piece, and you've kind of seen this tied through the whole presentation, is the milling initiative. Really near and dear to my heart. We've just upgraded from a really low-tech, what was called a simplicity bandsaw mill. We were doing everything manually to a wood miser, which is hydraulics. It's a lot more dialed, and we were able to really up our game a lot. In last winter, we produced what I'm estimating over $75,000 worth of lumber just through salvaged wood in a couple months.
That's huge. Wow.
This year, you know, there was that terrible storm in December. We pulled over 80 logs from Rocky River. They're at our yard. They're marked and ready to go. We're still identifying a few more. And it's going to be, you know, the next generation. And you can see this is some stuff at Sylvan Loop at the bottom. And then the other one is the Cleveland Hiking Club Trail at West Creek with the downtown overlook. And we do go back through there. We're cleaning them. We're restaining them to make sure that, you know, the milled wood can continue to have the maximum possible lifespan as well. So.
That's impressive.
Thank you. Yeah. It's just, you know, and I think that's just like, when I think of Cleveland, I think of these hardwoods. This is what makes, you know, Metro Parks majestic, is these white oaks, these walnuts, and being able to take that and put that into the trail. And, you know,
absolutely,
it broke my heart to see all those trees down, but to know that they're going to continue to be part of our conservation mission moving forward, like, gives me this level of satisfaction that it's just really good. So.
And all this work is with your team and Metro Parks staff, like, everything. You're not hiring out for any of this.
Yeah, so it's me, our team partnering with other divisions and a huge volunteer arm. And that's what we really, you know, we really want to just strengthen that volunteer arm, getting the community to understand what they're doing, be part of the story. Then they become part of the conservation mission. They're better stewards. And I think we're seeing
it's a great story.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Just kind of behind the scenes data just a little bit. So in 2020, Ralph's full-time staff, which consisted of four, was on payroll, obviously. Everything else that he did as far as seasonal salaries, as far as all construction materials and any equipment that he had to buy was all done through donations through the Park District. Natalie Ronayne and her team has been very successful continuously raising funds for the Trails Fund. And that has been our primary source of funding for almost all of his activities, including the equipment that you see as far as the trailers, the track dumps, and the wood miser itself. So the support that we're receiving on the donation end and on the grants end as well, we're also able to accomplish a lot of work through grant funding, has been phenomenal. And he's almost now to the point where we can operate most of our activities based on those donations and grants. So
what equipment do you like? Are you using a mini track hoe? Is that Caterpillar that you bought?
Multiple mini track hoes.
Yeah.
So Ralph's primary equipment is we do have one mini excavator. It's a Cat 301, if I'm not mistaken, that he does use primarily, which you've seen around in pictures. Today, at the board, earlier in the board meeting, there was the purchase of a Cat mini excavator.
Yeah.
So that's going to our site division because it's a little bit bigger machine.
Okay.
We're taking our site's 2012 John Deere 35. We're passing that down to Ralph because that's right in the realm of size of machine that he uses all the time. And in the past, we have been renting, and we've been tracking our renting costs over the past 3 years. And we've now gotten to the point where it's more of a benefit for us to purchase a new machine because he's using it so much versus renting one. So that's what that purchase today was. It's actually a roll-down effect that's going to benefit the Trails Division as well. Also on his inventory, we have an array of sizes of tracked dumps that you've seen. Some are larger, all the way down to walk behind track wheelbarrows. And then there's the milling operation as well.
Very good. Thank you.
What's next for 2021, Ralph?
Well, the opening of the Brexville Gorge project.
Which was fully funded by donors.
Yep. So, you know, obviously continuing the sign initiative, Hinckley's done. We're getting the volunteers ready for them. We're moving into Brexville on that end. We're looking at our mountain biking management, so trying to do some more of those kind of small projects, maybe some minor expansion, you know, looking for some small reroute opportunities there. And I know we were doing some planning around the Henry Church Rock Trail at the bottom of South Chagrin. So I think that what we've done at the Brexville Gorge is sort of set the blueprint forward that we can continue to sort of do that kind of legacy work. So getting right down in that trail that runs along the Chagrin River and improving it. It really got decimated from that storm in December as well.
Very good.
And then hopefully more. We'll see.
Tell your crew thank you for the wonderful work. We appreciate the presentation.
Can I ask one question first? If you had 30 or 40 people that, you know, school age people that dropped into the program, would that help you or would it hurt you?
I think it's really about the capacity and stuff like that. So I mean we've added on these new roles as trail coordinators, and you know, that's kind of like a little sample of what I think the vision is. You know, we have a big park district. I think if we're able to kind of take some pieces below me and say, okay, like, you know, you're responsible for North Chagrin and South Chagrin, and you're just kind of like the caretakers of there. You can do small level expansion and kind of partner with those groups a bit. You know, I think we tried to do that, but you have to remember our scale is really small. Right now it's me. You know, we have three union people, and then I have these two coordinators. So we could probably do it for certain projects, but I think we just want to make sure that it's like appropriate for like the scale of what we're working at.
More isn't necessarily better.
Yeah, I understand that completely.
Because all that,
yeah.
We've had that happen where we've had crews go out and they do things. And
these guys are misinterpreting what you said.
I know exactly.
We're misinterpreting anything.
It was a plan. It's the first year, first meeting, so I was a little play. But the point is that we've had these work groups come in, and then we've had to go back through and actually redo the work. So I will tell you, you know, the amount of work and the capacity continues to grow. I will also say each park manager is becoming more responsible and more part of the cog of the wheel to maintain some of these things, so it's not all falling on Ralph. So it's an evolution of the system, I think, is what I can say.
Yeah, and I understand that. I think that if you look at what Ralph has done in these highly, well-fitted flagstone, and it's quite intricate what you've been able to do, and that's WPA quality. That's top grade quality. And I have a feeling that what is going to happen in this next administration is you're going to get some sort of a WPA project, and I think some sort of funding that's going to fund young people who are going to have a terrible, yeah, like CCC or something like that, not on quite as big not a General Marshall type scale, but something more subdued. But I'll bet we could get 50 people out of this if we could use them.
You know,
and I'd love it, Ralph, if you could look through your friends in other states that are doing this, and seeing if they're seeing where the grapes are on the vine. I'm not sure where they are, but I think they're going to emerge.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I mean, from the large scale group, though, I would say like before COVID, you know, I remember doing like, it was like orientation. I forget the school or whatever, but we did bring, you know, for restoration projects, we bring 50 or 60 people out and we can cover a lot of ground and a lot of land. And it's unskilled work that you can do, like, you know, in a day. In terms of like that WPA CCC model, you know, I think, you know, we looked at for 2021 using what's called like ACE, which is similar to like a conservation core group. So they're pulling people from like all over the country who are interested in conservation, giving them baseline training before they come to us. So that kind of helps give us, you know, takes a little bit off of our plate. And then also they're quarantined together. So we're able to like have, like one of the problems we had with seasonal crews is, you know, I'm used to packing 7 or 8 kids in a truck, mm-hmm. and that was my crew capacity. You got to totally go away from that this year. So a lot of it was like having people meet right up at the trailhead on job sites. So we had to be like super prepared, you know, for anything, you know, because they were kind of stuck at that location every day. So I know that those things exist naturally. Ohio could really use one, like its own conservation corps. Other states have one. So, more to come.
Where we've had a lot of success with large groups like you're speaking of is Ralph has brought a very technical aspect to trail building that in the past has really never been considered. Yeah. And what we've realized is that with the volunteer efforts, if they're properly trained on our techniques, then it works out great, but there's a lot of management that has to go hand in hand with their efforts. Large scale groups, we've had a lot of success doing trail maintenance, not necessarily trail building, but trail maintenance and restoration, like we were talking about decommissioning, because that's very unskilled, very heavy manpower required. We're able to utilize those maybe untrained volunteers to get big projects like that done. So.
Gosh, thank you.
Thank you, team.
This was great. We've never seen.
Yeah, very interesting. Thank you. The work you're doing is extraordinary, and it's the lifeblood of the park system. That's terrific.
You're no fun.
He thinks it's your phone. Your phone ringing. Yeah.
That was the last info item. There is no old business. There is no executive session. The next regularly scheduled meeting is Thursday, February 18th at Cleveland Metro Park City.
Very good. Do we have a motion for adjournment?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Great way to kick off the year.
Yeah, very. Really this was a good. Great presentation. I loved it.
There you go.